apologies. No apologies.
But it's very challenging. We realize Parliament takes their work very seriously. It's important work, and so that's very encouraging.
No, thank you very much. But we take it as just because you are just one family. It's a continuation of the meeting. I'm under the impression that you have no desire to compete with justice with the amount of time they took.
We let them win on that one.
That's good.
I'm sure your honourable members are on the same page.
Honourable Bethemba has got a lot of stamina. She can go on to the show. Thank you very much to the NDPP and the team from the National Prosecuting Authority, and to welcome everybody who is on the digital platform and those who are watching from home. Over to you, NDPP.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Before I proceed, could I ask the colleague from the NPA to slide the presentation? I understand it's someone from Parliament. That's what my team tells me, that we'll slide the presentation. Thank you very much for that. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, I'm joined today by the Deputy National Directors and their teams, as well as the Investigating Director. And without further ado, given the time, I'm going to proceed with our presentation. Can we move to the first slide, please, or the next slide? Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, firstly, let me say you've received quite a lengthy presentation. I think it's around 50 slides. In fact, 60, but just to let to assure the committee that we are going to take a number of slides as read, and so therefore we do not intend to go through each and every slide and with all the detail in the slides, but we would be happy to take questions. The committee has the information. We thought that in the interest of transparency and being accountability, that we should give you the information so that you're able to ask us questions on it. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, we return to the committee to report on the progress and impact that the NPA has made in what has been a really very, very challenging and unpredictable environment in this past year. Last year, when we appeared before the committee, we presented our plans and the interventions and really stressed that it is our objective to create and to achieve this, what we call IPAC NPA, independent, professional, accountable, and credible. A lot of progress has been made in the implementation of these plans, but we do know there's still a long road to go. It is part of our five-year plan, and there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, and we need to do better. One of the first action steps was to really look at what in this past year. You will see that the performance has declined. This has the impact. One of the priorities, one of the top priorities of NPA was to dealing with high profile corruption matters. Progress has been made in this regard, but we must acknowledge and accept it's been patchy and it's too slow. We have prioritized dealing with corruption. And specifically dealing with capacitating and supporting the ID, which is a critical entity in fighting corruption. But unfortunately, in this past year, COVID-19 really derailed a lot of our plans. And when COVID hit the country was already reeling from the devastating effects of corruption and state capture. And the NPA was not spared. And so this has had a very negative impact on our performance in the past year. However, during this year, the important and good thing is that we were, as the NPA, able to continue to deliver uninterrupted services, and a lot of chamber work was done, and so prosecutors were able to finalize a lot more of the decision dockets and including some relating to complex corruption matters. We've also in this time focused on trying to get our own house in order. There's still work to be done. It's work in progress. And there are significant projects to deal with enhancing efficiency, effectiveness, getting more capacity, capabilities, and dealing with staff morale. Honourable members, in this presentation, we are going to focus more at a high level strategic. Sorry, I haven't been asking. My apologies. I think we're fine with that slide. We will focus much more on a high level strategic level to demonstrate how we have tried as the NPA to respond to the number of challenges that are facing the NPA, as well as more broadly the criminal justice system. The good news is we are making progress, but the reality is there's still so much of work to be done. I feel confident that the light at the end of the tunnel is getting a little bit brighter, perhaps a little more within reach, but there's still a lot more hurdles to cross. But failure is not an option for our country. Just to explain before I get to the cross-cutting strategic initiative, the structure of the presentation, and I hope I'm not going too fast, I'm just in the interest of time going a little bit quicker, is we're going to firstly, there will be an introduction and an overview by myself, and we are also representing the performance of last year, but as well as looking at the broader report of the National Director in terms of Section 22.4G of the NPA Act. So then I will deal with the cross-cutting strategic initiatives, which you see on the slide before you. We will then deal with the overall performance, which I will also deal with, of the NPA against the annual performance plan for 2020-2021, that's the past year. And then we will look at, just briefly touch on, our performance thus far, year to date, in 2021-2022, that's the Q1 and Q2 progress to date. We will then present our priorities for impact. You will note that when we presented the last time, we talked about our prioritization and what we were going to do for impact in the 6 months. And the various EXCO leads will present on those 6 months' priorities and the progress we've made to date. And then we will present certain key strategic initiatives that are focusing on NPA priorities. Corruption, TRC cases, FATF matters, hugely important, FATF, Financial Action Task Team, asset forfeiture, the ID, as well as digitization, which is hugely important. So we'll present those strategic priorities and what our plans are in that regard. We will then do a very short slide on our prioritization for impact, our new six-month priorities moving forward, and then the budgeting issues, and finally I will conclude with the way forward. So with that outline, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, getting to the cross-cutting strategic issues, building on what was referred to as the IPAC organisation, independent, professional, accountable and credible, is one of our 5-year really important strategic initiatives. And so all this in itself is a strategic initiative, but all of our other initiatives are linked and designed to strengthen the NPA to become this independent, professional, accountable, and ultimately credible organization. As I said, we are trying to get our own house in order, and so part of the professionalism stream deals with us holding prosecutors that are corrupt or unethical to account, and ensuring that we're trying to ensure to the extent that we can that disciplinary processes move quickly and an absolutely zero tolerance approach to corruption and dishonesty within the NPA. The independence of the NPA, which we have also raised, remains a key cross-cutting strategic initiative. On behalf of the NPA, I submitted an affidavit to the Zondo Commission, which in our view makes up a very solid legal case for the de jure as well as the de facto independence of the NPA. I won't go into any details, but I just like to inform the committee of that. I've also discussed this, sent a copy to the minister. We've had initial discussions with the minister, and we're hoping to establish a working group so that we can be on the same page in terms of the independence of the NPA, which you as the chair has also expressed is really important for the portfolio committee. The Office of Complaints and Ethics is progressing well. We have draft proposals with regard to regulations, changes in terms of the NPA Act. We have the mandates being drafted, looking at staffing requirements, and we're hoping that all of this will be finalized by the 30th of November this year. And this will certainly also assist us in promoting accountability insofar as NPA staff is concerned, including the top leadership and presidential appointments. Innovation, I've mentioned the Innovation and Policy Support Office, which has been created now as a permanent resource within the structure of the NPA. And it is, you know, in order to drive innovation across the NPA, the president has also stressed the importance of innovation in government. Most of us don't have the time with our day jobs to do this, so creating this capacity to drive innovation is hugely important. And so IPSO has also developed and supported many projects across the NPA and is providing support to various business units. Next slide, please. The Community Prosecution Initiative, which I also mentioned at a previous session with this committee, we have established, to remind the committee, 22 community prosecution sites, 2 per division. We've created posts because we do want to institutionalize this. The focus is really looking at public safety issues in communities and looking at how, together with various together with the community to start off with, and then various partners in a particular community, the prosecutor works to deal with crimes that are plaguing a particular community. GBV, for example, stop theft in certain areas, and you know, crime that is driven by alcohol and drugs. So it's a proactive approach to dealing with public safety issues with the prosecutor being involved. And we're hoping that the impact of this will be measured over the next 2 years. Non-trial resolution policy is being developed, and which will provide for agreements based on international best practice and looking at the local realities. And we hope that this will also be able to assist us in bringing back more effectively some of the stolen assets and some of the money that the country has lost through corruption. Colleagues, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, We are aware that crime in this country is you know, off the charts, so to speak. In as much as we are doing a whole lot, people still do not feel safe. And we realize in the NPA that we cannot simply be doing things the way we've been doing it all along. We have to, even in the lower courts, you know, we talk about prioritization of high-level cases, but we've got to start prioritizing for impact even in the lower courts. So we've had initial discussions with our colleagues and staffs, is that we need to, for example, have a policy on prioritizing housebreaking and house robberies. A survey in South Africa has shown that this is the crime that causes the most amount of fear and people feeling unsafe in South Africa. So we're looking to be able to prioritize these particular crime types, so that together with our partner and steps, we can have a very focused approach being driven by statistics in terms of where we prioritize and make sure that we're able to measure the impact and hopefully target those criminal gangs that are involved in housebreaking and not dealing with the odd, you know, housebreaker, one here, one there. We really want to look at those that do housebreaking as a career and try to target that and in the process have an impact on housebreaking in South Africa. This is one example of the type of prioritization policy and innovation we want to try to introduce in the NPA. Enhancing communication has been identified as a key strategic initiative across the NPA and is now at the center of all our strategic priorities. We have really upped and revamped our internal communications. We're working on the external communications, our intranet, and we're hoping to have a really good informative website, cutting edge website, developed and launched soon. Next slide, please. So this particular, we now come to the NPA annual performance plan targets for last year. We achieved 7 out of 14 indicators, which I accept is 50%, which is not good. And so we just want to these this particular slide. 4 of these targets are E&E targets. I'm not going to go into the detail of this, but I do not want to sound defensive about this, but I suppose just by saying that I'm already sounding defensive. But we cannot underestimate the impact of COVID on the ports and the productivity of the ports in the past year. But in this time, what we have managed to do is really try to up the quality of our prosecution. So our conviction rates remained very high. So the quality was not affected. We've enhanced collaboration. We've had to frequently adapt and innovate in our working environment because it kept changing. You know, there was short notice for decontamination. Staff was required to isolate and all of the things that you know about. And so we really had to try to be able to do things efficiently, you know, very quickly. New charge sheets had to be developed for the regulations, etc. We had to reorganize skills. Prosecutors had to do things that they didn't normally do, and it wasn't ordinarily part of their duties. So this resulted in some level of expansion of skills. And of course, digitization was, you know, there was a lot of more awareness, and, you know, with utilization of technology, it certainly showed us that we can do things differently and more effectively without being physically present in the same space. Next slide, please. I think we've gone one slide too far. We can go one slide back, please. We should be on slide 7. Okay, so these are the targets that were not achieved. So, you know, it's important to note that the numbers alone do not provide the full picture. In as much as these were not achieved, and we accept that, many of the targets were only marginally not achieved. For example, if you look at them, you know, 2.8% below the target of 93%. So it's we continuously pushing ourselves, and you know, but we've missed some of these targets, not significantly. And you know, for example, even if you look at the number of persons convicted for private sector corruption, you know, it's a significant number, but we haven't reached our target. So we are putting in plans in place to ensure, and you will see from when I talk about our Q1 and Q2 performance thus far, we are certainly on track to meet our target this year. Next slide, please. So, next slide. Yes, this is the one. So this slide deals with the asset forfeiture figures. I think it's important to note, I mean, the asset forfeiture, the value of seizing orders and the value of recoveries certainly do not look good. And part of this, the reason for this is that some of the reasons that I mentioned earlier on with regard to COVID, but also with regard to Chapter 6 preservation orders, and there's significant investigations that need to be done before we can move on any with regard to freezing orders in many of these cases. And so, you know, that has had a negative impact. But if you look at Q1 and Q2, thus far this year, we have already exceeded our targets with regard to freezing orders by 45%. So we're certainly hoping that in this year, we will in fact exceed our targets that we have set for them, for the AFU in terms of freezing orders and the values of recoveries. If we can move to the next slide, please. So, colleagues, this is a slide where we've tried to set out the reasons for not achieving the targets in the key reasons, 2020, 2021. I mentioned the impact of COVID-19. Importantly in that regard is the NPA was particularly affected by the pandemic in that 22.5 5, almost 22.5% of our staff members were infected. 1,111 staff members. So 22.47 in the NPA, as compared to the norm of 4.86 in South Africa, is really very, very high. And to understand that when one staff member was infected, then everyone that came into contact with that staff member has got to isolate. And so it has quite a devastating impact on the capacity of the prosecutors in the office. And this also applies to magistrates, to SAPS, other Department of Justice colleagues, where there's been a similar trend. And this has had a serious impact on the courts in the past year. And sadly, the death rate in the NPA was also markedly higher than the rest of South Africa. We've lost a number of colleagues. Money laundering matters, you know, they have a number of charges, they complicated financial investigations, trials are protected, there's lots of legal challenges. That's another reason. Lack of skill and capacity. This is a very, very, very important issue. And not even moving forward, lack of skill and capacity to deal with highly complex cases is still a very, very serious challenge, not just in the NPA, but in the SAPS as well. And, you know, we're trying to capacitate with ID, but the ID is going to deal with a very small percentage of these cases. If we do not properly capacitate the SAPS, we are going to have serious problems in trying to deal with these issues, even moving forward. And then there's some, you know, the figures declined. There was a decrease in cases coming in during this year as well as a decrease in the finalization of cases for all the reasons that I mentioned. Next slide, please. So, so this slide deals with, the, as I mentioned earlier, the 2021 and 2022 targets achieved. What is important is that we learned a lot of important lessons on how to work under COVID conditions and to respond. And we're hoping that this year, even if we go into a fourth wave, that the impact will not be as devastating as last year. And so if you look for now at this stage, the NPA has achieved the targets of 9 of its indicators in the current year. And so we actually quite confident that we'll be able to achieve the rest of our indicators for this year. Two indicators were not achieved in the, so far. Sorry, let me repeat that. Two indicators that were not achieved in the previous financial year were achieved in the first 6 months of the current financial year. And this is the number of persons convicted for private sector corruption and the value of freezing orders for corruption, all offences related to corruption. With regard to sentences, Tutuzela care centres, I just want to highlight that the courts are really imposing very, very high for sexual offences. You see the conviction rate is 73.4%. The courts are really imposing high sentences, 109 life sentences, 20 to 25 years, we have 51 cases, and 10 to 19 years of imprisonment, 204 cases. But the reality is that, again, this is not making impact on sexual and gender-based violence in our country. And, you know, the justice system is never going to be able to deal with this problem. A lot more needs to be done. And I know a lot is happening, but regrettably, we still have a long way to go in this regard. Next slide, please. Next slide, please. Yes, thank you. So this slide deals with the targets that were, that are not achieved thus far in the first 6 months. 4 indicators out of 13 have not been achieved. But as I said, we are not far off, and I'm confident that we can catch up. You can have a look at the figures yourself. Some of the targets were just marginally not achieved. You know, although they have not been achieved, I think significant progress has been made in terms of these strategic indicators. Progress has also been made with regard to the AFU operational indicators, as you will see in the grey blocks. Next slide, please. We've set out here the reasons for targets not being achieved currently in this financial year, and I don't. It's clear from, you know, again, we continue to the impacts of COVID are still being felt. SAPS reported crime during this year has decreased remarkably. So that has also impacted on the number of cases that are coming in. The volume of cases has declined. And so we really need to look at what's going on here, because we do know that crime is rising. And so, you know, it's something that with SAP, there needs to be analysis in terms of why this is happening with regard to the decline of cases that are coming into the year. But it seems like now there is a steady increase. So hoping that will turn around. The unrest this year, of course, also in July in JZN had a severe impact on the courts. The malware attack on the Department of Justice server also impacted severely on communications, although the finalization of cases were not seriously affected. Network connectivity issues still remain an issue, and they are. You will hear from one of my deputies that when he deals with the digitization, that this is one of the key priorities. Next slide. Honourable Chair, honourable colleagues, that is the introduction on my part and dealing with some of, and dealing with the performance targets. You will recall when we last met, I think it was the last time, but we did report to the portfolio committee on our 6-month prioritization for impact. And I now hand over to the ExCo leads, starting with Advocate Labaji, who will deal with each of the 4 priorities. I think if you go to the next slide, let me just make sure I am correct in terms of our. Yes, thank you. Advocate Rabaji, over to you with regard to the first priority. And this is with regard to our 6-month priorities that we had set up about decided on 6 months ago. So this is just giving feedback to the committee on this. Advocate Rabaji.
Thank you very much, NDPP. Thank you, honorable members, for this opportunity. If we could turn to the slide on fighting corruption, expediting high profile. Yes, thank you very much, Chairperson. This is one of the areas where we feel that we're beginning to make impact. So I was the champion lead to coordinate the fight against corruption for the IDAFU-SCCU. We worked very well with our DPCI partners. In this regard, we prioritized 10 cases. And as and when a matter gets enrolled, an asset forfeiture has happened, we put in another case. So in total, we have enrolled 9 out of 14 cases. And in this list, we include the high-profile asset recoveries that you have seen, the $1.4 billion in the Eskom Kusile power station matter, the 520 unlimited restraint order, in respect of Nulani Investment, which is one of the Gupta link companies, the list there is stated. So over and above this, working with DPCI, who were committed to the process, the head of serious economic crime, the head of high profile corruption, we said in the room and we made sure that the investigating officers out of this case, who are investigating these cases, gave account, and we pushed and made sure that the matters are enrolled. We're still continuing with this process. In fact, I met General Levea last week, who promised to allocate more senior DPCI officials to help me with this process, because as the NDPP explained, without the investigations being done and finalized by our DPCI colleagues, we won't be able to make traction. But this is one of those projects that we thought we have made impact and it's been successful. So in this list here, I haven't shown all the 14 cases. I've just highlighted those that we have made significant impact on. Thank you, NDPP and honourable members.
Sorry, I've been muted and speaking to myself. Next slide, please, at the Cock. And colleagues, let's just be a little more succinct. I think I was a bit long. Apologies for that, but let's deal with the key issues. At the Cock.
Thank you,
NDPP, good afternoon to the chairperson of the committee. Thank you very much. Yes, chairperson.
Yes, you know, it's not me today. It's the NDPP. I did not say anything.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's not me today. It's the NDPP.
Yes, I've noticed you've been very quiet.
Manage my team.
You've been very quiet, Chair, so I'm a bit worried about what's coming later. But thank you very much. Honorable Chairperson and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity. I will deal with the second priority, and that is in relation to our focus on serious violent crime, organized crime, which include gender-based violence and the femicide. The slide that you have before you talks a bit about the organized crime capacity within the MPA. And just to remind the committee that in each director of public prosecution's office, we have dedicated organized crime prosecutors who are seized with dealing with those matters as listed on the slide, the important ones being cash in transit, robberies, criminal gangs, organized crime groupings. It's out of this component that many of our racketeering prosecutions are launched, and so they deal with very high complex organized crime cases. There's good cooperation from an external stakeholder point of view, and this is also where the work in relation to some of the work in relation to OECD and FATF money laundering is also located with our SECU components. We have forged our relationships and improved our relationships with the SAFs, DPCI and the FIC to ensure effective planning and sustainable success in reducing organized and serious crime and the implementation of various strategies. Just to say that we acknowledge that there's a lot of work to be done in the organized crime space, and the development of a national organized crime strategy still remains a critical intervention that needs to take place. In this regard, the MPA is in discussion with the DPCI as the lead agency. Our organized crime components were involved in the public unrest cases of July 2021, and many of the matters are still currently being handled through the organized crime components, particularly in KZN and Gauteng. And then, of course, the issue of whistleblowers remains a critical aspect for the MPA. And in this regard, we are participating in initiatives under the umbrella of the ACTG to ensure the safety of whistleblowers and the safety, the continued safety of witnesses in witness protection. We can quickly move to the next slide. The next slide would just indicate some of the successes that we have achieved, both in relation to organized crime and gender-based violence, during the performance year under review. And you will see that we have a very high conviction rate in our organized crime cases of 96%. The number of matters which informs that percentage is 99%. And there's been a total number of 160 accused persons that's been convicted. The question around cable theft and critical infrastructure, in those matters, the conviction rate is 96%, and it affected one or two accused persons. Importantly, in terms of gender-based violence, this was the year in which we started to look at the femicide matters, where we try to identify those cases on court rolls, and we ensured that there was a prioritization of those matters. We achieved 231 femicide convictions with a conviction rate of 94%. Now, in the MPA, the conviction rate for murder cases are 75%. That's the target that we always strive to achieve. So this is a very good indicator of the manner in which the MPA, through our support in the soccer unit and through our dedicated sexual offences courts and our specialist prosecutors in sexual offences matters, the manner in which they are dealing with these matters. Now, out of that 231,
190 of those matters were intimate partner femicide cases. And once again, there you see a conviction rate of 93%. We can move to the next slide, please, and this will be the second last slide. Out of the approach that we followed, some of the strategies that we put in place to improve our performance in this area, a GBV training module and strategic plan has been developed within the MPA. We are focusing strongly on communication and also communication to our communities. And this is something that we're really going to ramp up going forward. The femicide, child murder, LGBTIQ plus databases are being developed. SOCA will analyze the information once collected to identify interventions that are needed and to develop protocols to address these interventions. So again, the focus on the very vulnerable. The D&I prioritization task team was established. Now, the committee will remember there was a huge challenge in the forensic labs of the police. The MPA initiated a prioritization task team to ensure that we could assist the forensic labs to prioritize these matters and to get the results of these matters to our courts. That was done to avoid cases being struck with the court rolls. So there's been a measure of success in that regard. We have also conducted a case audit in relation to all our organized crime cases across the country. And that is good work that is being taken forward, which will also inform the National Organized Crime Strategy, as I've indicated, that is currently being worked on. If we can move to the last slide that I have to present at this stage. So the following ACARA-funded TCC sites were identified to be completed by March 22. COVID-19 has impacted on our ability to roll out the TCC sites. Those are the sites that are in the pipeline. The first five are the five that were identified as part of the rollout, and BRITS is a new site, a sixth site that we want to do. So although these sites are not fully operational yet, we hope to complete it by the end of March 22. But two out of those sites are already functioning, although they are not functioning. It's limited services that we are providing there, and that's Cranach and Paul. The clearing of the backlog cases in relation to the GBV and the tracking of the DNA reports I've mentioned. And so far, the SOCA unit at the national office have received 2,743 reports to date out of that initiative of collaboration between the MPA and the forensic labs. And of course, these forensic reports were very important to ensure that we could get those convictions, some of them that are reflected in those femicide figures that I've just given to you. So in 59 reports for the same accused, which straddles clusters or divisions, hence indicating the modus operandi possible serial rapist. So what we started to pick up through this process is that we can coordinate better. And of course, where we pick up the same accused in different parts of the country, we are now able to ensure that working with the police, we can add additional charges in those particular matters. So thank you very much. That is all from our side at this stage.
Thank you very much. That's Project 2. Project 3, capacity in the MPA. That's good to see.
Thank you very much, Wendy.
Thank you very much, Wendy.
The sound, yeah.
Sorry, Chair. Maybe, yeah, Anton, you can perhaps use this. Yeah.
Thanks, colleague. Sorry, the mute, the echo in the room was a problem. As the NDPP mentioned at the beginning, we are looking at getting our own house in order, and one of the key priorities there is around capacitation and particularly around skills development. So we've really focused a lot on this, and it's not just about the numbers of staff that we try to bring in terms of appointments, both internal and external, but also developing the skills and expertise of our staff members to deal with the growing complexity of the kinds of crimes we need to deal with, including complex corruption cases and the growing needs to be able to deal with cybercrime. So in terms of the numbers, you have them all on your screen there. I just wanted to show you in terms of the previous year, we've increased the capacity of the organization by 10%. And that's really due to 700 posts that were advertised and 930 permanent appointments that were made. More than half of those permanent appointments were external appointments, which is very important. We did focus on representativity in those appointments, and especially in bringing young people into the organization. We, in addition to that, we appointed 425 aspirant prosecutors to our aspirant prosecutors program that have now been placed. And I'll speak about training in a moment. And we're also going to be bringing in 230 new aspirants in January 2022. So we're moving ahead nicely with that capacity building initiative. We still have too much, our vacancy rate is still too high. It's at 20% for prosecutors, but with the efforts I mentioned now, we are hoping to bring that down. And this year alone, we have filled 529 additional prosecutors' posts, which will help deal with that vacancy rate. Next slide, please. But as I said, it's not just about numbers, it's also about skills. So we have really upped our training. We've provided a number of planned training programs, as you can see, over 1,500 of those. But with COVID, we've also been able to use a bit of extra capacity and extra innovation around training platforms, and we've conducted almost 800 unplanned training programs. And you know, this is a really important capacity issue for us, especially as we are bringing in new staff. There's no point just in training ourselves, though, so we have focused on collaboration and our training with other partners, particularly DPCI. And beyond training, we've also developed other programs to develop capacity, including mentorship programs for our junior staff. And we really are aiming to ramp this up in the coming year, building on the experience that we've got from the program within the FCCU. We're also very excited about the upgrading of the capacity of Justice College, and we're collaborating extensively with Justice College and plan to expand that in 2022. I mentioned the Aspirant Prosecutors Program. We're trying to improve that and the tailoring of those skills to specialization. We're going to be putting our Aspirant Prosecutors Program through specialized training programs so that we can allocate them to our specialist units to develop tailored capacity from an early age, early phase of employment. Last point to mention, colleagues, is the question of the LT10 matter that's currently awaiting judgment before the Supreme Court of Appeal. This will have a huge impact on our ability to bring in the required capacity. And depending on what the outcome of the judgment is, we have strategies in place to be able to deal with the LT10 matter, which is very important, particularly in terms of our more specialized capacity at the more senior level. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Next slide, please. Yes, and the last priority in terms of 6 month priority, Edward Mokatla. Next slide, please.
Chairperson and Honourable Members, I should talk to you about the enhancement of the staff morale and well-being. This slide is very self-explanatory and I'm rushing through because of time, but I'd like to pause and say on bullet number one, I'd like to specifically mention the webinar that was launched and hosted by the Institute on racial inclusion and how it was a very big success. Bullet number two, I'd like to stop and pause and talk about the improvement of the support services to all the staff members. This is shown also in the report that we get to the survey that we undertook in getting the staff to convey the services themselves and even independent surveys. So to speak, we are having an evaluation of our services from the same staff members who are really getting the services that they are receiving from support section. There has been a broad sexual harassment policy that I'm asking, and I must stop here and tell you that this is a policy that also covers you when you come to the HBA building. As a visitor, you are protected, and this policy really is going to make you feel safe while you're on the ground.
No harassment in the MTA.
There's no harassment going to MTA. The next bullet, the user-friendly MTA internet portal, is where the MTA talk about the enhancement of our website. This is a portal that we use to communicate with the staff members, to transmit information, to be transparent, that every EXCO will keep them EXCO communication that goes out, every mental, every decision that is made, the staff will then know about the access to information is also enhanced through the portal. Bullet number five will also be the launchpad for what the MTP is going to be talking about just after I called now. As you recall, that we once asked us about the happenings, especially in the Eastern Cape. This program under the staff enhancement, staff morale enhancement and well-being. Visit the undertaken, information was received from the ground, from the people, and we took from those concerns which were raised by the staff members, and which culminated into the initiatives that were launched and undertaken and implemented. And so the NDCP is going to touch upon exactly that, the Eastern Cape intervention. Thank you for
Thank you. Thank you very much, Advocate Mohatla. Just to inform the Honourable Chair and committee members that there will be a formal memorandum that will be sent to you sometime next week. But just very briefly, I think our last report on this was we informed the committee that there was an investigation that was being conducted by Advocate Luvuyo Bono. He submitted a comprehensive report with various recommendations, and there was an intervention team that was put in place from head office together with the management in the Eastern Cape to implement interventions that were identified in order to address the issues. Regrettably, there were still complaints after that. Then, as you will also recall, there was industrial action in the NPA at the NPA premises. We then engaged with the group on the 10th of February this year. Regrettably, after a six-hour meeting, there was no way forward. We then, part of during that discussion, we had actually stated that, you know, that they should try to join in the chamber so that, you know, we could in a formal way deal with the matters in the bargaining chamber. There was still then thereafter, you know, there were still complaints, and so we then again agreed to get an informal meeting at the bargaining chamber in order to, you know, try to find a common way forward, try to find common ground so that we can move forward together. Regrettably, again, I think I would be diplomatic and say this was not a constructive meeting, and we were not able to find a constructive way forward. You know, the last was we received several letters as well from the union, NUPSAL, and my last was a letter to NUPSAL in which we basically advised them that, you know, we want to address these issues, but we need to do it in a constructive way, otherwise it becomes difficult to find a way forward. So that is the status, but there will be a memo that will come to the committee very soon, next week. Next slide, please.
So are you talking about the prosecutors from the Eastern Cape?
Yes, I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear on the chair. That is correct.
Yes, because there are people who are watching, so they must know the background. There are people who are watching from home.
Yes, apologies for that.
Okay.
Thank you. It is about the Eastern Cape prosecutors, Chair. Thank you. We now move on to strategic initiatives that are focusing on our APP priority issues. Next slide, please. And the first one, understanding these corruption, Advocate de Kock. He will deal with a couple of the strategic issues that fall under his portfolio, and then we'll move on to the other, with the other DNDPPs. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, NDPP. Chairperson, before I commence with this, I'd just like to acknowledge the presence on this platform of Advocate Lebo Baloyi, as well as Advocate Bonnie Curry Gumwo, and just to remind ourselves that they were appointed as special directors, one in the soccer unit, and Advocate Baloyi in the SECU unit, head of that unit that deals with corruption work. And that those appointments happened during the reporting period that we are reviewing at this point. And then just to indicate, in September 2021, Advocate Andrea Johnson was appointed as the acting special director for our PCLU, and she also takes responsibility for the organized crime component within the National Prosecuting Services. So these are the colleagues that are at the forefront of driving. Yes,
I think it will be better as you introduce them, they switch on their data so that you can see them.
Oh, I see. So if I can just ask Advocate Baloyi to please switch on the video. And I can't really see the pictures on my side, so I'm not sure if the videos are going on, Chairperson. I'll switch mine off. And if I can ask Advocate Curry Gumwo to put on her video.
Well, Chair, if you could advise us to be visible, because I can't also see it on my screen.
Oh, you can't see them.
Yeah, so we can't see them for some reason, Chairperson.
Let's try, because I did see the Chairperson. If your video is on, Advocate Cox, can we see you?
Yes, we do. My video is currently on.
Okay, all right, thank you, Honourable Chair.
So I'll proceed, I'll try to get the colleagues at some point to maybe in question
yes,
time.
Yes, I suppose as well.
Yeah.
Please go ahead.
Thank you.
A suspense of charge from Honourable Dayton.
What was that?
I have no doubt about that. She is convicted as charged. Please go ahead, Advocate Cox.
Chairperson, our focus on corruption has received a lot of attention during this year. And I think the main issue that we were trying to ensure, and that is why Advocate Rabaji started the presentation, was around questions of coordination, both internally and externally, and how we ensure that we start to make an impact. And so I think that we are demonstrating that is starting to happen. And that we will enhance the pace within which we are able to bring matters to our courts, particularly to our special commercial crimes courts. This is one of the successes, I think, for the system in the past year, that we have created those additional courts. And as the committee heard this morning, those courts are functional throughout the country at the moment. These will be the platforms, including our high courts, where we will bring these matters. So we have introduced monthly case management meetings, both at an external level and an internal level. So externally, it's the case management meeting of the anti-corruption task team, at which Advocate Baloyi will lead with the colleagues of the DPCI to ensure that the matters that are identified on the priority lists of cases are receiving the necessary attention. And internally, we have convened case management meetings under my leadership with the directors of public prosecutions, but also then include the regional heads of the SECU in particular, to ensure that the cases are receiving the necessary traction. Since April 2021, 32 new cases have been added to this list. And then we also have been dealing with the fusion center cases. Currently, there are 50 cases on the court rolls involving 65 accused. The report that we have, during the period, 5 of the 10 ACTT priority corruption cases identified in collaboration with ACTT stakeholders have been enrolled. And, of course, the ACTT stakeholders would include the DPCI that leads the ACTT. It includes the SIU, the FIC, Treasury, some of the key government departments that have to participate at that level. The collaboration with the DPCI, National Treasury, SIU, FIC reduced the time to obtain forensic reports and case flow analysis. This was a big focus area for us to improve our capacity, and there is currently an initiative around investigating the ability of the state to do its own forensic reports. So that work is also in progress. The DPP and DPCI priority corruption list flowing from the MPA 2019 workshop. So this was a combination of cases that we identified between our various divisions in the MPA and the DPCI, where we identified 93 corruption matters, and these are complex corruption matters. Out of those 93 matters, 48 of them have been enrolled. In 8 matters, decisions were made to decline prosecution. If we can move to the next slide. The next slide, it just gives you a visual of a breakdown of where those corruption cases are located. So I'm not going to go through all of them, just to indicate that the totals are reflected at the bottom, 93, the 48 cases, those are where they are enrolled in those divisions. And there are the 8 decisions not to prosecute. And currently, we have enrolled 60% of the matters that we targeted to enroll. So that's quite a good achievement. And like I say, we will enhance that going forward. We can move to the next slide, please. So it's really unfortunate that we do have examples of prosecutors being convicted for corruption as well. There's still a focus on government officials as far as corruption work is concerned. The slide that the MPA, that the NDPP spoke to at the beginning of the presentation indicated those cases of government officials convicted, and there were prosecutors, tax officials included in those numbers. In the MPA, we are making progress on internal and criminal investigations. I receive a monthly report of these matters, and we're following them very closely, particularly where senior members of the prosecution were involved. There are currently cases involving senior members of the prosecution that are on the court rolls. Even though corruption is a priority crime in terms of the directives issued by the minister, during COVID-19, trials are slow to advance and to be completed on our court rolls. We have spoken about the backlogs and that is still impacting on our ability to finalize these cases. Especially in serious corruption, we find that interlocutory applications are being used by defense counsel, and this also impacts on our ability speedily finalize these matters. So the environment within which the prosecution is working is highly complex, and the adversarial system of justice that we have in our country impacts on our ability to speedily move these cases. We are, of course, doing everything in our power to ensure that these cases can move through our courts. I think that Advocate Du Plessis spoke earlier about our drive to appoint younger persons, and this slide is just for your information to give you a breakdown on race, gender, and youth in terms of some of the appointments that we've made within the corruption area. I think we can move to the next slide, Polly. So, after the TRC cases,
gently up the pace a little bit.
Thank you for the gentle reminder, NDPP. The TRC cases remains a very, very serious concern to the MPA. We have engaged quite in quite a very serious way around how best to improve our ability to deal with our TRC matters and to bring justice to those victims and families in relation to this period. So we have made a decision that the TRC work is located in our organized crime components in the provinces. We additional resources are being appointed on 3-year contracts. We've started that process in all of our divisions to make sure that the prosecutors that are assigned to do the TRC work are dedicated prosecutors. The idea is that they won't do any other work. Even if there's 2 or 3 TRC cases in a particular DPP office, these prosecutors will only have to work on those matters. The DPCI have also appointed investigating officers on a contract basis, and some of the permanent investigating officers are also assigned to the TRC work. And these prosecutors and investigators will follow a project management approach to deal with the TRC matters. At the national office, we are also appointing dedicated prosecutors to help, to oversee, monitor, and to ensure that best practices and constraints are dealt with in the divisions. National will provide the strategic oversight of the work, and of course the prosecutions themselves will happen within our divisions. 5 enrollments have been made. Unfortunately, 1 accused passed away on the 6th of September. The reconstruction of records remains a major constraint in relation to this work, and particularly the matters that are held in our archives are also remaining a challenge. And some of the archive work is marked as at secret, which means that we have to follow certain procedures to get access to those documents. But this work is carrying on apace at the moment. The DPP officers are now engaging with families directly to keep them informed of progress. I think this is a big area. The prosecution has been criticized in the past for the slow pace of this work and also for not keeping family members informed. So our approach will be that the family and the victims will be put at the center and that our prosecutors will be directed and instructed to ensure that families and victims are kept up to date regarding the work of the TRC cases. We may move to the next slide. So, Chairperson, there are 6 slides dealing with the PATAF mutual evaluation report that speaks to the issues around money laundering and terror financing. I think that we've agreed that we would not go through those slides. We have provided all of this information to the committee, and we are happy to take questions on those slides. But just to emphasize that our international obligations in relation to money laundering and terror financing is an absolute priority for the MPA. We are working very closely with the FIC and with our other partners within the country to ensure that we can address some of the negative findings that were made by FATF in relation to the mutual evaluation report of 2014, 2015, 2018, 2019 in relation to the country. That report was recently released and it received lots of negative publicity. So our approach is that a lot of work has happened, some of it in relation to the money laundering work of the prosecution and the investigations. We've developed a joint training manual to deal with the serious commercial crime in conjunction with the police. That includes the money laundering training. We have just completed now in October 2021 training in all our divisions in relation to these important aspects, and this training was hugely successful. There's a lot of positive lessons that we've learned from this training. Lots of this training occurred on virtual platforms. We are now trying to ensure that the training will happen physically, and it's a continuous rollout of this. The effect of recommendations have been highlighted, the money laundering with foreign predicate offending, and we've already secured 2 such convictions during the course of this year, which is good news in terms of our international obligations. A money laundering desk has been established in the MPA. The NDPP appointed a number of senior officials to assist with this work. They meet on a regular basis and they engage with the colleagues in the other government departments to try and address the pattern recommendations. An MPA action plan has been formulated and work is continuing in this regard. We've achieved 27 convictions in money laundering cases during this period. This is similar to the last period in Q2. And we are now arguing for steeper sentences when we achieve money laundering convictions. And we want to ensure that this happens across all the divisions of the MPA, including our tax units, where these cases will also feature going forward. So I think, Chairperson, the other slides, you can just have a look at them. The next slide. It deals with the issues that were flagged by the mutual evaluation report, and it will show what the findings were: non-compliant, partially compliant, moderately effective in relation to some of the ratings. And then if we go through all of the slides, we move to the next one. I'm just explaining the slide in the beginning. It will indicate the actions that we have taken in relation to those outcomes that were identified that needed attention. So you will see the same format has been followed until page 40 of the 41 of the slides that you have in your position. So then that is my part. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Advocate Rabachi.
Thank you again, NDPP. Just briefly on the last financial year, in this period, a special director of public prosecutions was appointed, Advocate Priya Bisesa. Priya, if you could put on your camera, please, so that the chairperson and the committee members can be reminded of your face. I think you've showed it once. I'll switch off my face.
Thank you, Advocate Rabachi. My camera is on. I'm not sure if I do appear.
How's it going, Priya? It's a bad time.
Thank you. Thank you, Advocate.
Welcome. Yes, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Captain. So in the previous financial year, one of the things was to capacitate ASU, and I have done. We've achieved some progress as far as that is concerned. We still have to appoint deputies and regional heads in most of the provinces. Currently, ASU only have got 3 regional heads. So whilst we've gone some way in capacitating the unit, we still have to continue to capacitate the unit. We've also, in the process, strengthened partnerships. I did explain that AFU work is predicated on DPCI having to do investigations both for Chapter 5 and Chapter 6 to show criminality before you can seize assets. So we're in the process of finalizing co-location with DPCI. In fact, in some provinces, the DPCI investigators have already co-located with AFU. Next slide. Chairperson, this is a slide showing some of the significant cases that we have done in the various areas for the annual targets. And as my colleague Advocate Dukov explained, our international obligations, we have to look into all areas of crimes. We have to seize assets in the areas that have been indicated on the slides here are Rod Gold, foreign predicate, offending, Diamond Pawns Skins. We participated in working with our colleagues at DPCI FIC at the Fusion Center to make sure that we also seize those funds that were part of UIF fraud. Next slide. And all these cases were done then in the previous financial year. Next slide. This is the continuation. As I said, we have to continue to do work in the drug space, precious metals, fraud, theft, as well as money laundering. Next slide. We're also part of a team with our other partners in the law enforcement space, led by FIC in illicit financial flows, and those are the amounts, environmental cases, to make sure that we achieve our targets as far as these areas are concerned as well. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you, NDPP, and honorable members.
Thank you, Advocate Raji. Advocate Pronia.
Thank you, NDPP. Good afternoon, honorable members. Honorable members, I won't repeat what my colleagues who have gone before me have already said about some of the work that we've been doing. I'll just highlight the issues that I think weren't addressed. So the NDPP commented on the fact that the asset recovery targets in relation to corruption were not met in the previous financial year. I just wanted to add that that is probably largely accounted for by the fact that the 1.6 billion rand restraint order that the ID obtained in relation to Regiment's capital was set aside. That matter has gone on appeal, and the appeal is in fact being argued on Monday. In addition, I think I would just like to point out that there are two other areas where the ID collaborated with its partners, and so the recovery was not done into the criminal assets recovery account, but there's the 1.5 billion rand case where ABB paid back 1.5 billion to Eskom, which we worked with the SIU and Eskom on jointly. And then there was the in excess of 700 million that was paid back to Transnet by McKinsey, where we supported Transnet as well as the Zondo Commission. So while those recoveries don't accrue directly to the NPA, certainly there's no debate that the ID played a significant role in those recoveries. The ID is a relatively small capacity in the NPA. When it was originally established, it was sort of in a holding pattern while the anti-corruption, national anti-corruption strategy was to be implemented, and the Zondo Commission was to report on its recommendations in relation to ensuring that we're better able to deal with state capture. As we all know, those two interventions are still winding their way through the systems, and we don't yet have clarity on those issues. In the meantime, the ID has been capacitating itself with secondments, contract appointments, and operated as if it was not going to be around for very long. I think there's no acknowledgement and acceptance that dealing with serious corruption will remain a feature of the criminal justice landscape for some years to come. And the NPA Exco recently took a decision to create a permanent structure for the ID. One of the issues that impacted adversely, in addition to the other factors raised by my colleagues, is the recruitment drive of the NPA. offered opportunities for permanent appointment to some of the contract appointees in the ID that caused some disruption. And just some of the investigators that were appointed on contract also found it fairly untenable to be in insecure employment relationships. And so we lost some staff to permanent appointments there as well. That issue is now being addressed by a plan to create a permanent structure for the ID on the NPA establishment. And we're hoping to have that structure in place, or at least approved, at the beginning of the next financial year. The second issue, I think, that hasn't had an impact on the ID in particular in the last financial year and continues to have an impact is the extensions granted to the Commission, the State Capture Commission. So there are plans in place in the ID to deal with the conclusion of the Commission's work and the recommendations that, judging by some of the public hearings, we anticipate will come out of it. One of the things that has been ongoing is a committee dealing with the digital forensics capability that the Zondo Commission has established and that the Department of Justice has acquired. Plans are at an advanced stage to relocate that capacity to the ID as soon as the Commission completes its work. And we've been anticipating that to happen in 3-month intervals over the last year. And it has caused quite a bit of disruption to our ability to plan and work smoothly. The other issue that my colleagues from the NPA administration will address is the additional funding given to, I'm sorry, I'm not keeping track of the slides, so if you can move to the next slide. One of the issues that we have been dealing with is, in addition to is the budgetary allocation. So what we've recognized is that there's a need to seriously scale up on the skills. That, you know, our situation in the NPA is pretty dire. When it comes to the skills required to do big corruption cases, particularly cases that are data intensive and have vast amounts of documents and data that we have to sift through to make sure that we have properly investigated matters. So we've done well to recruit from some of the personnel that were available to the Zondo Commission doing this kind of work. So in the areas of digital forensics, financial analysis, mobile analysis, and just e-discovery, we've been able to recruit some of the Zondo personnel or contractors formerly employed by Zondo to provide those services to the ID, and that's making a big difference. We've been given a budget to renew licenses of some of the state-of-the-art capacity that's been available to the Zondo Commission. But once we are able to migrate the actual hardware, we should be in a position to fully capitalize on the capacity that will ultimately be available to us. I think the last issue I think that's significant to the work of the ID is we are looking forward to either at least policy changes, but also potentially legislative changes dealing with non-trial resolution, as the NDP said at the outset. This is an issue that is of particular significance to the work of the ID, because there are a number of international corporations who are interested in conducting non-trial resolution agreements with the ID to assist in reaching a resolution around corruption at SOEs. And without a proper policy or legislative framework in place to guide the IED, we don't have the tools that our colleagues in other jurisdictions have available to resolve these matters. And there are at least three other matters where we're working together with colleagues in other jurisdictions, and we are hamstrung by the absence of a legislative regime. So the IED, I think, has managed to punch above its weight in fairly difficult circumstances in the last year or two, with greater certainty around a structure, increase in the budget. I think we are on track to really realize the strategies and plans that we have put in place. But of course, there are still many frustrations that lay ahead. But I think the one of the achievements that we celebrated a month ago was finally being able to move into a building and having the different members of our multidisciplinary team actually move into one space and sit around one table and actually pool their skills towards solving some of our more intractable problems. So we are on track and we're moving forward, and we hope to have many more successes in the next half of the financial year to meet the targets that we have that have been set. Thank you, members.
Thanks, Simeon. Agrikunya, Anton, IPPC, and the last strategic initiative focusing on APP priorities is digitization.
Thanks, colleagues, and I will be short. We are getting to the end, I promise. I know it's late. We touched on the question of digitization, and I know the Minister and the DG have raised it this morning. I know it's a priority for the Department of Justice. It's certainly a priority for us, not only in terms of how we work internally and leverage the benefits of modernization and digitization, but also, of course, in terms of how we engage with the changing nature of the criminal landscape in terms of cybercrime. So it's a multifaceted approach. It's a certainly a priority for us in terms of our work. I'm not going to go into too many aspects of it. I'm just going to touch more internally what we've done, particularly in the context of ECMS implementation. And just to say that this comes, it's one of the other benefits of COVID, that it's helped us with a mind shift change that was needed to move people beyond the sort of more manual approach into the more digital world. And I think just the fact of being forced to collaborate on different platforms and use digital technology in different ways has been a big benefit. In terms of our ECMS implementation, I'm just going to give three examples. The one is the digital docket development. This is aimed at improving collaboration between the SAFs and the NCA on sharing docket information electronically. It's vital in terms of becoming a modern, efficient criminal justice system. There are a number of pilot sites that have been identified and that targeted, and we'll be finalizing this rollout of this first pilot phase in 2021. We've looked at it also in the context of our High Court modules with ECMS, where we've developed the delivery of a High Court prosecutions model that is linked to the lower courts. So therefore, referrals of dockets between the lower courts and High Courts for enrollment is improved. And currently, this is over 70% complete. And we will also be finalizing this process by the end of December this year, which is going to be a huge step forward in terms of the collaboration and efficiency between our lower and higher courts. And the final one to highlight is the ECMS Asset Forfeiture Unit, where we've been piloting a case manager process for AFU matters, and the project commenced already, is well on its way, and we expect to finalize this by April 2022 and then take the lessons learned from this particular unit and then roll it out to other units. So we are making progress. Of course, again, the ransomware attack and the impact of that across the government, particularly across the NCA, again, demonstrated the importance of us ramping up our ability and capability to deal with this. But of course, as the DG mentioned this morning, we're also a little bit hamstrung by outdated hardware and systems, and obviously that comes with budget implications. So we're not quite at the perhaps at the state stage where the DG has suggested justice was, but we certainly need to look at our budgets and our infrastructure and our hardware, as well as our software, which we'll have to develop in parallel to the capacity development and skills that come with being a modern 21st century contribution center. Thank you.
Thank you, Anton. It's the next issue. Item is the budgeting, and Ms. Morakile will deal with that on the board chair and honorable members. Before we get there, did I jump a slide? There's just one slide before that. My apologies. This will be very quick. Very recently, we had a workshop in the NPA and looked at the next 6 months forward-looking in terms of looking again at what should be prioritized for impact in the next 6 months. Advocate Kok, if you could take us very quickly through your one slide.
Thank you very much, NDPP. Honorable members, the leadership of the MPA, which included the directors of public prosecutions throughout the country, recently met to discuss the question of our priorities for the new financial year. And just to inform the committee, although the focus areas of the past 6 months that we have just spoken to will remain important focus areas for the work, there was a unanimous decision that the main priority will be corruption. The MPA leadership has decided that to enhance the MPA's credibility, it's important that we have a clear plan how to deal with corruption. So this is going to be the project that we're going to focus on in the next 6 months, effective from January 2022. But of course, the work continues and the work happens as we are speaking. Just in 2 weeks' time, we are going to go away with all the DPPs of the country for a two-day planning session. And a lot of this will be fleshed out in terms of how we're going to enhance the credibility of the MPA through effective prosecution of corruption. Just to say that the areas that we will focus on will be collaborations, both internally and externally, assets recovery, skills enhancement, and communications, both internally and externally. On the collaboration, just to flight that it's going to be very important for the MPA to develop a single integrated MPA strategy for corruption cases. We're going to agree on our prioritization criteria. We're going to create a single database for all corruption matters. We're going to monitor all corruption cases until completion. We're going to establish case review panels that will review and assist in each priority case that we are dealing with. We are going to identify skilled, complex corruption and commercial crime prosecutors to assist us with this work, and we're going to assign skilled prosecutors to each prioritized matter. These are just some of it. We of course will finalize all of these plans in the next 2 weeks, and hopefully by the end of November, beginning December, the MPA Exco will adopt the prioritized focus in relation to corruption. So when we return to the committee next year, this will be the area that we'll be using as our prioritization for the work of the MPA. Thank you very much, NDPP.
Thank you, Advocate Kok. And the budgeting is the final aspect, Ms. Morakile. The floor is yours. Next slide, please.
Thank you, NDPP, and thank you, Honourable Members. Currently, the MPA budget spending is a little lower than the anticipated linear projection. This is due to the non-implementation of the cost of living adjustment and the non-receipt of invoices from suppliers. However, the MPA has serious concerns about the MTF budget allocation, due to the continuous increase in the need for capacity in specialized areas, such as the ID, AFU, SCCU, and SOCA. This slide talks to the 2021 budget. The NPA's total budget allocation for the current financial year is 4.535 billion. As at the end of October 2021, we had spent 55.58% of the budget. We project an overall spending break even with the exception of compensation of employees at the end of the financial year. Although we project the break even in respect of goods and services, our projection excludes certain IT priorities, which we are not able to fund within the current budget allocation. Next slide, please. The NPA's budget increases with an average of 1.56% over the MTF period, which is well below the current inflation rate of 4.39%. Next slide, please. I'm not going to go into details with regard to this slide. It indicates the budget baseline reduction in 2020. Yeah. Next slide. Honorable members, if the NPA is not sufficiently funded, it will not be able to efficiently deliver on its mandate. Mm. And therefore, we will be failing the South African population. It is for this reason that National Treasury is urged to review their position to reduce the NPA budget and reconsider current position in relation to outer year. It is for this reason that National Treasury is urged to review their position to reduce the NPA budget and to reconsider current position in relation to outside year. Next slide, please. As it is currently, the NPA can absorb a budget baseline reduction in respect of current financial year. However, the proposed cut in respect of outer MTF years will cripple its ability to deliver on its mandate. This projection relating to compensation expenditure is based only on officials currently employed by the NPA, but it excludes appointments and resignations, as well as those cases that are currently before court. For example, the LT10 case and the case relating to the cost of living adjustment for previous years. For 1.5% for non-SMS and SMS members. The next slide, please. Honorable Chair, it is essential that the NPA is adequately funded. We have submitted a need request amounting to 363 million to National Treasury. As Advocate Gronde has already indicated, these funds will cover the growing workload in ID necessitated by the end of term of the State Capture Commission. The CARA fund is beneficial to NPA as it assists the organization tremendously. Since the allocation of CARA funds has been delayed, the units such as OWP and ASU are to a very great extent negatively affected. OWP is Witness Protection, Office of the Witness Protection. We will not be able to cover the increasing pressure in this unit. We therefore plead with the Portfolio Committee for their support to the NPA to ensure that we are sufficiently resourced.
Thank you very much, Ms. Molakile. Chair, that in conclusion, those are our presentations. In conclusion, Honourable Chair, I want to really stress that in as much as there's really a lot of good work taking place, there's plans, implementation, impacts of COVID has hampered that somewhat, but all of that said and done, as part of the broader JCPS cluster, we still have a very, very long way to go. The reality is, I mean, we can present our measures, our targets, and we can, you know, it's important that we try to achieve these targets. That's why we have them. But at the MPA, we set very high level, measures in terms of outcomes. And one of them is people feeling safe. The other is increasing investor confidence and access to MPA services is the third one. We know that people don't feel safe in South Africa. We know that perceptions of the criminal justice system and its efficiency and effectiveness, not just perceptions, but that there are serious issues in terms of effectiveness. And the FATF report is a huge indictment on our country's ability to have dealt with illicit financial flows, particularly money laundering and terror financing. Remember, what the report that was released was dealt with the assessment of 2014-2015, as well as 2018-2019. And so, you know, in that we had 10 years when the country did effectively very little or nothing to address this. And that is why we're sitting with really, really bad assessments. So you've heard about what's been put in place to deal with it, but it just increases the demand and the expectations of what the JCPS needs to do. The emerging crimes that we've heard about, the complex nature of crimes is really outpacing our ability to respond. Cybercrime, including more broadly cybersecurity, must be a national priority. Terrorism must be a national priority, perhaps to be dealt with at the National Security Council, if it's not already being dealt with there. Corruption remains rampant. We really need drastic improvements in the system, in the JCPS cluster, and we need them fast. Improved collaboration, we talked about that. The success of there are certain critical success factors with regard to the MPA. One of them is the SAPS and the efficiency of the South African Police Service. And so it's really important, in as much as we urge that there be no budget cuts to our really small budget of 4.5 billion rand, we really urge that the request that we've made for a small amount, a drop in the ocean, of additional funding is not rejected. And when we make this plea, I also make the plea, Honourable Chair, that the SAPS be properly, that there's support for the SAPS to be properly capacitated with the skills. It's not just about numbers and people. It's about getting the requisite skills to deal with these complex but also emerging crimes. And so, you know, they're really huge challenges. That said, we have a strategy, we have plans, and in the MPA, we will, notwithstanding all of these challenges, working with our partners, we remain committed to make sure that we do everything that is possible within our mandate to ensure that people, we're not just ticking boxes, that people do feel safer, that there is a greater investor confidence in South Africa, that victims of crime receive justice, and at the end of the day, that we serve the people of South Africa in the way that the social compact obliges us to do. Not just us, but law enforcement more broadly, and ultimately government. I thank you, Chair. And we stand ready to take questions, comments.
Thank you very much, NTPP, and to your team. Members. Honorable Dante. Followed by Honorable Breitenbach, and then Honorable Nebold Drachen, in that order. Honorable Janje.
Thank you, Chair. It's a long Friday, but very important. Let me also thank the team. who's been with us the whole day, Advocate Batoy and your team, for a good presentation of the work of the annual report, balanced with what you're planning to do. Chair, maybe just to make a general point, first of all, an important clarity that I seek to Advocate Batoy, because it would help to know whether I need to ask more probing questions. Advocate Batoy, you are, well, I think you need to just put things on the table on this issue. You are quoted as when you met with Scopa as having said the following, that we have serious reservations about the extent of detail that is being provided. We need to have a discussion on how we balance accountability with the possible compromise of very complex and sensitive investigations. I am starting with that to just share with you and invite your comment on that as to, is that the challenge that you have as NPA? Are you finding that us playing an oversight role, we could easily contribute to you not achieving some of the things that you want to achieve? Or else if you could a little bit expand on that statement, if it is true, and kind of help us so that we travel the journey with you properly. So I'm inviting you to take us into your confidence. Are you having a dilemma here? Is there a difficulty on this issue? So I really want to start with that, Chair. And I've got just three other areas that I want to probe. Because the kind of report I've been with you in your journey, as you know, from when you're born, when you're 9 months, this is now another milestone, and every turn of that, I would have summarized what your presentation is, and today I have a sense, having listened to you, that you're giving us a mixture of something, that the annual report of the period under review, from where I'm sitting, I just have a sense that you could have done much better, and that is being modest. You could have done just much better on the period under review. But when I balance that, and you really, with your team, have crafted the menu that you want to bring to us, because when I balance that with what we're putting forward as forward plan, the overriding feeling I live with is that there's a very good promise going forward under the NPA, which overshadows my little disappointment about that annual report of the previous period under review. I'm more excited about what either from your Rodney de Kock yourself, as you concluded, and everybody else, about what you are saying to us. From now on, this is what we're putting in place. I'm really excited about that packaging of things as compared to the record that is being presented that says this COVID year, this is what I was able to do. I thought I must just share that so that you understand I have mixed feelings as I interact with this, but it's more positive when I'm beginning to look forward. There seems to be a lot of things that can bear concrete results with this. And I also, Chair, just want to add my voice, because throughout this journey with Advocate Batoi, we've always been very, very firm and clear about us opposing as a committee any reductions in this institution. And I think we have not changed that position. If there is a need for us to step up on that issue, I'm sure Chairperson, we certainly can agree to do that in relation to issues of funding and so on. My next point, Chair, is that I am very serious about this FATF matter. It's a serious issue. Part of the problem is that the country for years has been inward looking. For years, the country has been inward looking, let alone the state capture phenomenon. But the country has been inward looking, and that report demonstrates that we have overlooked so much, as you have indicated, on these issues. And I think it's an area, Chair, I would have an interest on, in terms, even if we have to come back on that issue to follow that issue and see how far we go on that. Because South Africa will never be an island on its own, whatever that we do. And then my last two points, Chair, the Office of the Witness Protection. This had occupied headlines, correctly so. Not because people are theorizing about it, but you're dealing with real issues and problems. And sometimes very unfortunate that we have to talk about loss of life, which it's always difficult to deal with. And there seems to be a growing list. There seems to be a growing list of people not satisfied. Others have written books about how that environment, how that institution is not taken seriously, which is very critical in the fight against corruption. Because your focus is very clear. I have no doubt about it. I have no reason to not believe it. But that fight about corruption that you are lobbying us for, which I am in full support, you made the point. This fight is not just an NPA fight. It's going to need capacitated subs, your hawks. It's going to need all the other role players. But there's also the Office of the Witness Protection is a serious contributor to the fight against corruption. And I think it's got to be seen in that way. That when it is pushed back in the way it is, it becomes a serious matter. And I think there, Advocate Cronier raises the issue of Karachi. And I think we would have listened to Advocate Kosana earlier demonstrating how CARA funding is prioritized. And I think from the criteria that he was putting, there is no reason why the Office of the Witness Protection and other initiatives cannot be lobbied for and assisted in that regard in terms of CARA. So I just wanted to make that perhaps more as a comment. My last comment is your red notice. So maybe you need to speak to us about that. You got the country excited about the red notice to the Guptas, and just a few days later, it was retracted to say we're not there yet. So seems to be more than a glitch. Maybe if you can just comment on that and elaborate on that issue. Those are just a few issues in the form of comments that I really wanted to make. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janji, Honorable Dennis Beckenbach.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and good afternoon to everybody. I share the views of Honorable Janji that one must have mixed feelings about this interaction. Certainly an amount of disappointment that a lack of achievement. But also, I must agree, the plans look good, they sound good, they sound implementable. Not easily implementable, but implementable. They come a little late in the day. I think we were all hoping to see a lot more progress by this point. But I'm sure that goes for everybody in the NPO as well. So, not for one moment disregarding the difficulties that I know are there, and not for one moment playing down the magnitude of the job. But those things borne in mind, the fact of the matter is the NPO is the prosecuting authority in South Africa, and it does have to produce, regardless of the difficulties. So we can acknowledge the difficulties, we can try and ameliorate the difficulties, and try and address the difficulties, but it doesn't excuse non-performance. And there is a measure of non-performance. I'd like to start with the conviction rate. And you say they remain high. Well, yes, they may, but this isn't the first time I've raised this issue, and I'll continue to raise it until some sort of meaningful reporting is done about it. Conviction rates mean nothing to somebody who knows about conviction rates. They may be very impressive on paper to people who know nothing about how the courts function. But if you prosecute one case and you win it, that's 100% conviction rate. Not very good. If you prosecute 200 cases and you win one, that's quite appalling. So when you say you have good conviction rates and they remain high, it's meaningless. We need to know how many cases came into the system, how many cases were not enrolled and why, how many cases were enrolled for prosecution, how many of those cases were dealt with by alternative means? How many of those enrolled were withdrawn, and what happened to them after they were withdrawn? How many of those cases finalized with a conviction? And how many were acquitted? If you have that information, then we can decide whether your conviction rate is high or not, is it good or not. High is irrelevant. And unless there's some sort of meaningful reporting on a high conviction rate, the fact of a high conviction rate imparts absolutely no information and means nothing. Alternative dispute resolutions, and particularly the mediation aspect thereof, I have a difficulty with understanding. So I would like to know what the criteria is. Again, this relates to the conviction rate and the different methods of dealing with matters. What are the criteria? Who conducts these mediation efforts? What kind of quality control is there with regards to these activities? What kind of reporting is done with regards to these activities, and why do we not see it? I need to know where this is reflected and meaningfully reflected. So with sufficient information to be able to understand whether it's working or not working, whether it's an excuse to deal with criminal matters in an easy fashion. So I would like to see some more information on that. Then the CORA fund is a little worrying for me. Who audits the CORA fund? And where is this reflected? Who decides what funds are allocated where? And where is this reflected? And really, what are the CORA funds currently used for? I think the committee needs to have a lot more information about the CORA fund and what's happening to the money in it. And then LP10 was at least acknowledged, but glossed over quite glibly. LP10 is a serious issue. It is something that I will continue to raise until it is resolved. I'm not unaware of the difficulties. The fact of the matter is it's an untenable position, and it's becoming more and more untenable as time goes on. It's true that it's with the FCA at the moment. That's because you're appealing it.
Honorable President Bach, yes. I think for the purposes of the people who are listening, can you explain that one in a much more clearer way? I know it involves prosecutors, senior state advocates, and deputy directors of private prosecution, but there are people who are listening at home who might not have the background.
Sure, Honourable Chair, I'll try and do it succinctly. Basically, it boils down to the fact that historically, senior state advocates and advocates were entitled to make a career choice some time ago that put them on a path that didn't include management, which made them pure prosecutors, and they were put on a salary scale. The effect of that is, now the practical effect of it is that the senior deputy directors of public prosecution, who have been in that position for the last 10 or 15 years, earn significantly less than the people who report to them. They earn significantly less than the people whose work they are obliged to check. And they earn significantly less than the people that they are required to give direction to. It's an untenable situation. So you can have a senior state advocate earning much, much more than the deputy director of public prosecution. And it's not being rectified. Needless to say that the senior management who are caught in this trap are deeply unhappy, have been for years, completely demotivated and very, very angry. And they have, and quite rightfully so. And so what happens now is the NPA advertises Deputy Director of Public Prosecution position, appoints senior state advocates with no management experience to speak of at the top salary scale of a Deputy Director of Public Prosecution in order to make it worthwhile to apply for the job. But it completely flies in the face of those people who have been there for the last 10 years. And I'm not pretending that it's an easy thing to solve. I know it isn't. And I know that it's going to entail vast sums of money. But the fact of the matter is it must be addressed. It's been ignored, swept under the carpet, dealt with less tactfully sometimes and more tactfully at others, but no progress is made. And those deputy directors of public prosecutions are being prejudiced. They have no motivation. They are really angry, and I don't blame them. And this position cannot continue. And I see no real effort to address it. So when you say you have strategies in place, I'd like to know what those strategies are. It's no good saying to us, we've raised this 4 or 5 times now. It's no good saying to us, we have strategies in place. What are the strategies? How are you going to deal with it? I'm really pleased to hear that you're addressing the FATF report, because the FATF report is, as you have acknowledged, exceptionally damaging. And again, it's something that the NDPP has inherited. She can't be blamed for it, but unfortunately, it forced her to fix it. So, FATF, amongst other things, found that the Financial Intelligence Center efficiently produces operational financial intelligence, but law enforcement agencies lack the skills and the resources to productively investigate money laundering and terrorist financing. So while that is not necessarily, strictly speaking, solely an NPA responsibility, you have to prosecute those cases. So I'd like to know what interaction there is with senior management of the police to address the terrible paucity of skills in the police force. So we all know that there's an enormous vacuum of skills in the NPA with regards to prosecuting complex prosecutions. But the fact of the matter is that prosecutors can only prosecute that which is brought to them by the police. And there's very, very little skills in the police to deal with these complex matters, and so the prosecutors are hamstrung from the start. So there would have to be a team effort, some sort of joint effort between the NPA and the South African police to address this issue. For instance, I don't think the police have a detective agency anymore, a detective academy anymore. So I don't know where the detectives now get trained. It appears to me that they don't get trained if I look at the quality of the work that I see. So you have the skills getting old and leaving for a variety of reasons, and you have young people being employed with no skills and no opportunity to develop such skills. It's not an ideal situation. It must be addressed. It's also the case in the National Prosecuting Authority. So there have been, FATF found also that there have been some successful investigations and proactive identification and investigation but no proactive identification and investigation of laundering networks and professional money launderers. So what is going to be done to it? What specifically is going to be done to address that issue? Because, again, it requires very specific skills that are hard to come by and cannot be taught from a book. They need to be learnt in court. Anybody who thinks that a prosecutor can be produced by being lectured to or taught something out of a book is wrong. The skills of a prosecutor are learnt in court. By progressively exposing prosecutors to more and more complex matters. And they learn their craft in that fashion. So they make mistakes, everyone does, but hopefully they learn from them. But the skills that are within the NPA that could still deal with these matters are, again, growing old and leaving. They're either retiring or they're going to greener pastures where they get paid more. So what is being done to address that issue? But I've also noted that some good results were achieved confiscating criminal proceeds, but the struggle was to recover assets from state capture and proceeds that were moved to other countries. So is there any plan in place to up those skills? How are we going to recover those monies? Is there a plan? Is it being done? Is it being done successfully? And then FATF also noted that we must make better use of financial intelligence needs. Our financial intelligence needs to be more proactive. We must work proactively with international and partners to detect and seize illicit cash flows. Are we doing that? Are we working to build networks with international partners in that regard? And I have a question about the new SCCUs. Everybody is very impressed with the new SCCUs. There's one in every province now, I understand, and that is it's always nice to see expertise being rolled out. But my question is this, what expertise is being rolled out? There's already a shortage of skilled complex commercial crime prosecutors in the SCCUs that exist. So where are the skilled prosecutors in complex commercial crime coming from to prosecuting these new SCCUs? And is there really sufficient complex commercial crime in provinces like the Northwest and Limpopo and Mpumalanga to justify a specialized commercial crime court? Or would it not have been more productive to, as was done in the past, send prosecutors from offices as close by as possible to prosecute in those areas as and when the need arose, and to upskill the prosecutors in those courts to deal with commercial matters? Is there seriously sufficient commercial crime in those areas, complex commercial crime, to keep a specialized commercial crime court running? And then this is said somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it's almost ironic that the investigative directorate now needs funds. When we asked 2 years ago if they needed money, I remember very clearly Advocate Cronier's statement that they had plenty of money. I was surprised by that then, and I remain surprised by it. I see that the ID is looking at the serious corruption in the State Security Agency, and it's ongoing. Well, I'd like to hear about some progress there. South Africa has a very definite interest in that corruption and the shenanigans that went on there under Mr. Fraser. And what's happening with the planned network investigation? And why is no one being held accountable for the vast amount of money that were misappropriated? When the digital forensic capacity of the Zondo Commission is migrated to the NPA, is that, or to the investigative director, is that in a permanent capacity, or is it based on contracts and consultants? Because if it's based on contracts and consultants, then it's not really a solution. And then just the general skill deficit in the NPA, what is being done to address this? You know, very experienced people are retiring now, I'm sure, every month. They go home and do some gardening, and their skills are lost to the National Prosecuting Authority. Is there a plan in place to retain their skills? Is there a plan in place to use them as mentors for young prosecutors? Is there a plan in place to perhaps use their skills at Justice College? Because in prosecuting, there's just no substitute for experience. And it's a terrible thing that this kind of experience is being lost. And I can name 10 just sitting here now who have retired, whose skills are vital for the NPA. And I know that they're sitting at home planting daisies. It's a terrible loss of experience and know-how. It appears to me to be a huge waste. There was a question I had on the SOEs and the resolution of matters with the NPA. I didn't quite catch what was said in the presentation. It sounded to me like, I hope I'm wrong, that there was some sort of desire to resolve corruption matters of SOEs with the NPA, but it didn't result in a trial. If that's so, please could I have some more information on that? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Nimbos Krachens.
Thank you, Mr. President. I know it's been a long day, because my Wi-Fi is starting to disconnect from all my devices. So I hope everyone can get my question. So I'll try and be quick. Thank you to the NPA for your presentation. I know that COVID, was quite bad. And I'm very sorry to hear about all the officials that, passed away and those who tested positive. Hopefully they recovered fully. With that, I just wanted to know the percentage of the NPA staff and officials who have been vaccinated. I know this weekend is the second Boomer weekend, and we're trying to encourage people, to get themselves vaccinated. So if you can let me know what percentage has been vaccinated. Secondly, I'd like to look at slide 8. You don't need to put it on, but on slide 8, I'm trying to understand the wording. It says, in one of the gray blocks says 75% below target. So does this mean you only achieved 25% and then another block says 99% below target? So was only 1% of that target? I mean, the wording just confuses me a little bit, so you can just explain that a little bit more. And then in the previous financial year, it said that the TCCs were 58, but only 55 was achieved. So three targets were not achieved. So I'm just curious, where was it not achieved? And then on slide 20, you show six things listed, and those three that was not achieved in the previous financial year, is it included in those six? Then they identify to be completed in 2022. So those three that was not achieved in the previous financial year, is it included in the six to be completed in 2022? And 25% of vacancy, that is quite high compared to the requirement by DBSA of 10%. Now, 25%, how many positions does that equate to that are still vacant? And I see you, the numbers of witness protection being threatened or endangered at 000. But I'd like to know your whistleblowers. One whistleblower was shot and one whistleblower, ran overseas. Were they part of the witness protection program or not? What does the NPA do to make sure that any whistleblower is protected? And then the Fusion Center, I didn't hear anything, maybe it's not important, but I'm curious about the impact that the Fusion Center has on the work of the NPO. And I think that is all for now. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mustafa Chaira.
Since the battery is low, let me just speak. Pastor Chairperson, thank you very much, Advocate Batoy and the team. And then also, I think my colleagues have covered so many areas, Chairperson. I can only, I'm moving, I'm trying to get some more of power. So I'll be very much short. I can only emphasize on one issue. That's just Honorable Verma just raised the issue of whistleblowers. Let me just say, particularly those that went to a Zondo Commission, what is happening with them? What are we doing? Are we part of assisting in making sure that they are safe, including with many others, but in particular with those two, with that one, I will keep up this.
Also, the other question, I only maybe have one or two or three. I just want to know exactly, when are we getting a serious tangible progress on the issue of the perpetrators of the apartheid era, Advocate Patwe, on the issues that came from TRC? If we can get a report on that one, and also if there is no progress, why? If we can get that, not forgetting the issue of capacity that you keep on mentioning it, but I think there are other issues that we need to also to make sure that we give priority, and this is one of those issues. And then the other one, question, or maybe I would like to get more clarity, is on the matters of referrals. I'm not sure if my colleagues have covered us on that one, because you know, this gadget on and in, we are in, we are out, time and again. But particularly on the issues of COVID, the corruption COVID-19 matters, the SOE, and the municipality, if you can just give us information on the municipality and departmental corruption, and minimum maybe that we would think that we might get information from your side. But lastly, Chair, is this one of the ID, which is really giving us a concern when it comes to the issue of stability. They have not yet, it seems as if they have not yet got into shape, because they even talk about the issue of they still don't have space of their own. Maybe in better, lack of better ways to say they're homeless. If they can also give us more information on that one. Thank you, Chairperson.
Well, thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Just a very few things, because a lot has been covered by other members. One, can you give us an update on the state of matter? And then in the case of the state versus Toka, the decision by acting judge Nobaitobi, is the NPA preparing to appeal or not? And then in the recent cases, or the recent incidences around the issue of violence that erupted in July, don't you feel that highly pressured that some of the colleagues within the security cluster made promises to the public that they know who the perpetrators are? There was even a number, but even now nobody has been prosecuted. Don't you feel that in a way you were pressured to make such announcements whilst understanding that there still have to be thorough investigations first before, and some of the people you might find that you don't have a case to prove beyond reasonable doubt? So don't you feel that it was too early for some colleagues to make such statements? And those are the issues that put a lot of pressure on the NPA. Your comments on that, I think they will link with the first issue that Honorable Janji raised, that I think you were appearing before SCOPA. So I think in that case it was in the SCOPA. But now I'm talking about outside of Parliament and in the executive to make such statements. There is an issue that I would like to take a little bit forward from Honorable Breitenbach. How many cases where the NPA has refused to prosecute and they are private prosecutions? And then how many of those private prosecutions have succeeded, have resulted in a in convictions? I am still very concerned about the targets, especially for the recovery of money, because I am from a school of thought that says no credible investor, unless you talk about rogue investors, will invest in a country where there is a view that the rule of law is very weak. There is high levels of corruption. Now, you have a situation where people go to newspapers, go to the media, talk about hundreds of billions of rands that have been stolen, 500 billion. And when you have the targets from the NPA, you talk about 1.7 billion, 2 billion. And for me, it creates a serious disjunction. I know that some of the, you are basing your targets based on what you think is prosecutable. That's fair enough. But I do think that you will forever be under pressure if you are going to have people announcing these large sums of money, but on paper what we are actually pursuing is chalk and cheese compared to what is being announced outside. Because, I mean, ordinary South Africans have a view or a confidence that all those 500 billion that are being talked about, NPA is the only solution to those money is coming back to the fiscus. I think if you can have your comment on that. And then there is a fruitless and wasteful expenditure here relating to the abuse of the state vehicle. What were the circumstances around that? I know that it has been picked up by yourself and the Auditor General, but would not want to know what were the circumstances around that. But I am extremely tempted to agree with the view raised by Honorable Bettenbach around issues of convictions. If we do not have the full picture, I mean, they won't mean anything. Because generally you decide to prosecute, how many cases. So that conviction is more or less based on what you have decided to prosecute. But if we have the complete picture, it would be much more better to check if really those convictions mean what they're supposed to mean. And then the last thing, I don't understand, maybe you can explain to me, why is the regional court performing lower than the district court that is supposed to have more cases? And although it deals with more complex cases than the regional court, but it also performs lower than the higher court, than the high court. So what is the issue around the performance of the district courts? Those would be the questions on my side. Over to you, NDPP.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. I'm going to ask the managers in respect to the various portfolios to take questions relevant to their portfolios. So if I can start with Edgar de Kock. Edgar de Kock, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yes, thank you very much. I'm just trying to reorganize some of the papers on my table.
And I said to you.
question to Honorable Breitenbach around the issue of mediation. How does it work? Are there quality control measures in place? And how exactly do we approach it? So I think the starting point in relation to mediations is that the MPA has a policy framework in respect of mediations. It's contained in part 7 of the policy manual that has been approved, which deals with diversion, restorative justice, informal mediation, in respect of adult offenders. So I won't touch on diversion and restorative justice, but as far as the informal mediation is concerned, this is an alternative way to finalize and resolve criminal matters that are brought to the courts. Because of the historical issues of backlogs at our courts, years ago, the MPA embarked upon this process. It has always been part of our justice system. In the early years, prosecutors, lawyers would approach prosecutors or the senior public prosecutors and often engage around questions of how to resolve a case. And some of that led to withdrawals. So in the past, it was often just reflected as a withdrawal. As we matured in the system, we measured that as well, because we said you can't just reflect the case as a withdrawal when there was a reason why that matter was finalized in a particular way. So this was an attempt to demonstrate how matters are finalized in our courts. And over the years, we then looked at this question alive to the fact that we need to be consistent in the way in which we approach mediations in our courts and in the justice system as a whole. So as we speak, this is still an ongoing project. I think that we will have to come back to the committee through the department and the ministry to talk about whether or not this should be formalized, as we have in the Child Justice Act, and what the processes will be. That is the ideal. And I think that the South African Law Commission, one of the projects currently is to look at mediations and how it is formulated and finalized in the criminal justice system. So hopefully going forward, the committee will help us to better manage the mediations. At the moment, in terms of the policy framework of the MPA, the mediator can be a prosecutor, and the prosecutor may be assisted in the mediation process by a social worker or a professional mediator. But in the majority of instances, senior public prosecutors are engaging in these processes. We have put in place operational methods in terms of how it's done. And one of the strict requirements are that it must be contained in writing, so that there can be a quality control check in terms of that. The other important aspect of mediations are that informal mediations should only be considered for less serious statutory and common law offences. And so generally, informal mediations should not be considered in the following matters, and these are the criteria. Offences such as murder, rape, robbery with aggravating circumstances, and any other offence that falls within the minimum sentence legislation. Domestic violence is particularly excluded from mediation. Cases involving assault or threat of assault. Serious offences where victims may be classified as vulnerable or children. Where offences are racially motivated, mediation is excluded. Offences where a court will probably impose imprisonment without the option of a fine, that's excluded. And the accused has previously committed a similar offence, you would not qualify for mediation in those cases. So really we're talking about the less serious offences done by senior public prosecutors in our courts, in the district courts largely, and then the oversight
through the management structures of the MPA, chief prosecutors, the DPPs, and of course, the office of the NDPP. So where there's a complaint, certainly we always look into these issues, and from time to time, we do receive representations in respect of mediations. NDPP, there's a question on the CARA funding. I can touch on that briefly if you wish me to. Our understanding is that the CARA funding is managed through the Department of Justice, particularly in our developmental committee of the Department of Justice. That is where it is tracked, that is where the reports are delivered, and that is where motivations must be done to the cabinet committee that's responsible for allocation of funding in respect of the CARA funds. And so when we say that needs to happen, I think that the motivations for funding of CARA, new funding, that has not taken place. And I think the urgency around that is what is being sought. I'm just trying to locate some of the questions on my sheet. There was reference to the CRATF report that we have set out in detail in the report that we presented to you earlier. And some of the questions related to the Financial Intelligence Center's reports and law enforcement not activating investigations in respect of that report. Now, this is an area that we are aware of, and this is a concern that the Financial Intelligence Center has directly addressed with the cluster and with the DPCI in particular. And so measures are being put in place, and as indicated in our report, we are now involved in close collaboration as far as our training is concerned with the investigation. And these are not new investigating officers. These are seasoned investigating officers of the DPCI and seasoned prosecutors largely located within our specialized commercial crimes unit. And so we're doing exactly what Edward Breitenbach is proposing, and the training that we've completed now in October 2021 was training that included money laundering training and identifying exactly those suspicious transactions that are flagged by the FIC. So, one, joint training. Two, to experience investigators and prosecutors to enhance their ability to be able to do this work. And we're confident that this will lead to results. So we're going into a second phase of that. And this will also, we're also preparing for the new legislation that will deal with the Cyber Crimes Act. And we've already started our training in that regard again. So all these issues are really interrelated. And the idea that the prosecution is putting forward is that there must be a much stronger collaboration between the DPCI, the senior investigators, the FIC, National Treasury. And so we're pulling all of this together in the ACTT, where the heads of the various departments are sitting, including the NDPP. We meet once a month. And so hopefully all of these issues that are raised around FATF, that are raised around the concerns around how we're dealing with commercial crime and how we're dealing with corruption in particular, that this will be addressed. I also wish to remind the committee that the National Anti-Corruption Strategy has been adopted, and this will become our founding document in terms of the approach, in terms of how we're going to move forward. It speaks to many of the strategies that we are flagging, and in particular, it also speaks to the issues around whistleblowing. And so if we go to the anti-corruption strategy, we will see one of the key recommendations that have been flagged in relation to whistleblowing is the development of a national whistleblowing agency. So the whistleblowing agency, if this is going to be approved, will really look at how do we protect, how do we ensure that whistleblowers have a kind of one-stop center to which they can go
where they can receive services, including legal services. Often whistleblowers have to deal with labor disputes. So the idea will be whistleblowers need to be protected. But it cannot just be a criminal justice function. It's a broader societal function. And so hopefully those kinds of measures are the measures that have to be addressed going forward. Currently, through the ACTT leadership, through the Department of Justice, there's going to be a strong focus on reviewing the legislation that is dealing with whistleblowing. The legislation is key to ensure that we've got a better approach. But all whistleblowers will qualify for witness protection. And so when the MPA becomes aware of a whistleblower and becomes aware that a whistleblower is vulnerable, there is an engagement with the whistleblower or the witness to explain how witness protection works and to offer the witness protection to the witness or to the victim. So this is all ongoing processes within the prosecution. And when we say that there's a zero outcome in terms of deaths in our witness protection, it means that all the people that were taken onto the program, nobody's been harmed. That's important. But of course, the way in which you then identify a risk to a witness is very important. And that is the area that we have to improve upon. Because that is speaking to the investigating authorities, speaking to risk assessment in terms of vulnerable witnesses, and then putting in place measures to protect those witnesses. So those are also things that we are working on, and we realize that there are gaps that needs to be addressed in terms of how we are dealing with that. There was a question about the SECU courts, and the rationale behind the creation of the various specialized commercial crimes courts in different parts of all the provinces. I think as a matter of policy, it's important to ensure that there's uniform services to all our citizens, and the quality of our services need to be enhanced. So I think the rationale of creating the specialized commercial crimes courts is easily understandable. And I think we all must agree that going forward, whether it's a sexual offences court, whether it's a specialized commercial crimes court, whether it's any other specialized court, we need to have a uniform approach throughout the country. Of course, there are always going to be budgetary constraints, but I think that provides the rationale. And so what we have done is we try to ensure that there are adequate personnel that are appointed to each of those courts, particularly the provinces where this has not taken place previously. And so currently throughout the country, we have 259 prosecutors appointed within our specialized areas. And Chairperson, you will be aware that in many of the areas like Limpopo, Northwest, there are serious corruption cases that one are finding in these areas. And the model that said you locate prosecutors in a central point and then you send them to go do cases elsewhere, sometimes geographically 300 kilometers away from the central point, we find this doesn't work. You cannot prosecute a case from a national office. You cannot prosecute a case from a central office. The closer you put the investigators and prosecutors to the actual crimes where they are being committed, that is the best approach. And so that is what the approach has been following also in the commercial crimes arena. And we want to ensure that the work is being done, the skills are being developed in those areas where the crimes are being committed. And so our commitment is really to do that, to ensure that those colleagues in those regions have the ability to do the work. So the role of our national office becomes one of supporting, one of strategy, one of enhancing the skills, one of development and training, one of ensuring that there's sufficient resources for us to be able to do the work. So we're confident that this model is going to help us. But just to add as well, out of the 259 prosecutors that we currently have within our commercial crime space, 169 of them have experience of 10 years and more. And I think this is an important number, because it's not just the 20, 30-year-old, 30 years experienced prosecutors that can do the work. We are confident that given the opportunity,
all the prosecutors that are within the NPA will be able to do work of a particular quality and specialization. The challenge for the NPA is to ensure that those prosecutors are getting exposure to the work and they are being supported. So in our commercial crimes environment, when we have prosecutors 169 with 10 years and above, what we need to do is to enhance the skills levels of those colleagues. They are competent prosecutors, but there are certain areas of the work where they need additional skills. And so the joint training I'm talking about, working with the police, working with the detectives, is being done to enhance the skills of those prosecutors in particular. I'm hoping that my colleague, Advocate Duplessis, will come in and answer the general question around some of the developmental work that he touched on earlier in our case. Colleagues, I just need to pause because I just need to understand if there are any other questions I may have overlooked. My colleagues are just assisting me here. Software unit.
Can you allow other people to deal with your questions?
Yes. You can come back to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Because I think I've got the bulk of the questions here on my table. Thank you.
Okay.
Rodney, can I hand over to...
Advocate Bonnie Karigama will take the question on the TCCs. So perhaps she can just answer that question quickly for us.
And Advocate Toko, it's the rape appeal in the Eastern Cape. I think that's the chair of. Please go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Bonnie Karigama.
Good afternoon to the Honourable Chair and the Honourable Members. The question that related to the TCCs indeed. The target was 58 TCCs. That would have been an increase of 3 additional sites to the existing 55. The sites that were earmarked were Paul in the Western Cape, Craddock in the Eastern Cape, and Gapani in Limpopo. As indicated previously, 2 of the sites, Paul and Craddock specifically, are already rendering services. The services are being rendered to the victims that come from the relevant police station that would be serviced by Craddock and Paul PCCs. For this financial year, 120 victims have already been seen at Craddock and at Paul PCC. I would also just add that at the Paul PCC, a case manager has already been appointed, that is an advocate. And so therefore, that case manager is already studying the docket that would come to a Paul TCC, is already consulting with witnesses and aiding in dealing with the GBV cases that come through the Paul TCC. Then, in addition, a case manager has also been appointed at Gapani already and will now also be utilized for the work relating to Gapani TCC. So although not fully operational because of various factors, including that the space issue, we are ensuring that services that can be delivered are indeed delivered. I would also just add that in addition to these 3 sites, we have also embarked on a mission to identify potential new sites. In all, I think we are at, in addition to these particular 3, we're also looking at about 11 additional sites across the country. We are looking at donor funding, and we've acquired or engaged already with certain donors that will build for us, for example, in Limpopo, a TCC. So we are not just relying on the CARA funds. We are looking at other means and ways in which to establish additional TCCs. We are also looking at basically using a project perhaps that is started by a different stakeholder. For example, in the Mitchell's Plain in the Western Cape area, where a Nakosa has been received funds to build a structure, we have engaged now with Nakosa to say, you have the funds to build the TCC, but let us run it once the structure is in place. So already we're engaging with our stakeholders, with the police, with everybody, to ensure that that will also come to fruition. We are really engaging with the Department of Health. All our TCCs are on the premises of a hospital, an existing hospital. So we are looking at where are these hospitals in our various provinces, and we're engaging with BOH to see which other sites could we use as suitable potential new TCC sites, and we're engaging with the various stakeholders. Stakeholders being SAPS, BOH, DSD, and of course, and as you said, SAPS, and of course other NGOs that may be actively ready in those areas. So some of the sites we are looking at March 2022, some March 2023. But again, the establishment of a TCC is an expensive venture, but we are looking at really aggressively going out there and trying to find the funds, and not just be reliant on CARA funds, but also looking at other ways and means to ensure that we continue to increase the number of TCCs. If I hope that answers the question. If not, I'm available to answer any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Advocate Bonnie Kari Gamwell. The chairperson, I have found three other matters I need to address. The one is the question of the appeal matter, I think, that you raised. So I have called for a report from the DPP of the Eastern Cape. We have received a report on the matter from the DPP with a recommendation in the matter. But we've also assigned this on an urgent basis to our Sexual Offences and Community Affairs Unit, to the Special Director who has just spoken now. They are studying this report, and they are going to provide me with a expert opinion in terms of whether or not we can appeal in respect of the matter. So at this stage, I'm not going to disclose the recommendation of the DPP. We are still working on it in a nutshell, but we're working on this on an urgent basis going forward. On your question, Honourable Chair, relating to the Steinhoff matter, the Steinhoff matter is receiving a lot of attention as we speak. The Steinhoff matter is under the supervision, the direct supervision of the Director of Public Prosecutions for Pretoria, Gauteng, North Gauteng High Court. There's a team of prosecutors that are working with it, including one advocate that's been assigned from our SSU office at the national office. We are also working with other experts currently who are evaluating the reports that we receive in terms of the financial investigations. And we're at advanced stages of looking at this matter. For various reasons, I cannot go into too much detail. But just to say, we are now engaging with countries outside of South Africa. There's preparations in respect of various mutual legal assistance applications that we need to submit via the central authority. And in fact, one of them have already been dispatched to the NDPP for consideration so that it can move on to the central authority. So as far as Steinhoff is concerned, we hope that come the new year, that we will see some traction in terms of this matter. Of course, we retain our objectivity. We will wait until we have received all the information, and our prosecutors who are then seized with the matters will have to make the decisions whether or not there is sufficient evidence to proceed to charge any official with criminal misconduct. So I don't preempt that finding. I'm not in a position to preempt the finding because I'm not seized with the matter. But what I can say is that from our national office, we're doing a lot to support the DPP in Pretoria to ensure, one, that there's sufficient resources, two, that as far as mutual legal assistance are concerned, that those matters are getting the necessary support. And we've also assigned our international expert from the office of the NDPP to be part of the team. So I hope that covers it. If there's more information required, Chairperson, we will be happy to respond to that. Now the controversial issue around the conviction rate, and this of course is a matter that has come up before. And so you see, the fundamental approach of the prosecution has always been that we can only take responsibility for what is within our powers, because it relates to mandates. So there are mandates that police have to investigate crime, and there are mandates that the prosecution has to prosecute crime. And the structures that we have put in place via our constitution is that the police are investigating, the prosecution are prosecuting generally. Of course, we now have the ID that investigates and prosecutes. And so when we talk about the conviction rates, what the prosecution is saying is that when we receive a case docket from the police, our job is to ensure, one, that that case docket is properly investigated. We assist the police. We talk about DGI in our serious cases. We assist the police to ensure that they do their work. And we try to do that to the best of our ability, taking into account all the constraints within the system. But then we say, when we make a decision to prosecute, we will measure the effectiveness of that prosecution. And so that is how we determine our conviction rate. So we say, out of the cases that we receive from the police, the cases that we actually enroll, those are the ones that we count in. So when we're talking about the 90%, the 80%, etc., we do have those numbers, and they are contained in our annual report to reflect exactly how those totals are achieved. But so we are moving the prosecution, and this is what we spoke about earlier around innovation. And through the NDPP has repeatedly requested, what is the prioritization policy that we are going to apply? So what we want to do is we want to focus on the offenses that are causing the greatest harm to the country. And I think that should be the debate. Which are those offenses? We're starting to do that. Gender-based violence, sexual offenses, murders, robberies, those housebreaking, those are the offenses. So going forward, we are going to develop a policy to deal with prioritization, and then to say, how do the prosecution make those decisions in terms of which cases do you enroll? So if we say, for example, housebreaking is the offense that we need to really focus on, we need to ensure that the conviction rate generally in terms of housebreaking must improve. But we start with the police and we say, out of the total number of cases that you have received reports on, crimes have been committed, how do we enhance the investigation of those matters so that there can be a successful prosecution? And so these initiatives that we are busy with, and particularly the Community Prosecutions Initiative, is designed to improve the overall quality of the investigation, the overall decision-making that prosecutors receive. If we get a better product from the police, if we get better cooperation from communities, if we work closer with our communities, then we will get better investigation of our cases. So I think it's a debate that informs all aspects of the way in which we need to work together. And then we can start to say, once a crime is reported, what happened to the case? Was there a successful conviction? But we have not matured yet. I must admit that we are able to do that. We are not at that level. But I think that going forward, those are the kinds of discussions that we're going to have in the prosecution, and that we're going to ensure that we're going to improve the quality of the work that we do, and that we're going to focus on the correct matters that we take to court. Then it's linked to this informal mediation we spoke about earlier, and we say, where you can resolve a dispute that happened between neighbors, why do we have to take them to court? Why do we have to use critical court time to prosecute that when the two neighbors are telling us they want to settle the case? And so we want to say, there are certain offenses that you are not going to take to court. You are not going to prosecute. You can look at other ways. You can look at restorative justice. You can look at mediation. But then there are certain offences that you say are absolute priorities. And I think those are the offences that we want to ensure. We want to improve the quality of the investigations so that ultimately more and more and more of those convictions are sustained in those matters. But as we speak, that is the way in which we are counting them. But we are really focusing on the quality of the work that the prosecutor does. Because if that conviction rate drops, and let me remind the committee, when we started 20 years ago, the conviction rate in rape was 42%, if my memory serves me correctly. We then made a decision to make an intervention. What was the intervention? Sexual offences court to the Tutuzela Care Centre. And currently, the Tutuzela Care Centre cases are achieving a 76% conviction. So I'm saying, let us not underestimate the importance of focusing on the conviction rate as we have it. Because we have demonstrated that when you focus on the conviction rate, you actually improve the quality, one, of the investigation, two, the quality of the prosecution, because then you're focusing the prosecutor's mind in terms of what they need to deliver in the outcomes. So I know I've said a lot, but I think what I'm saying in a nutshell is that we need to prioritize one. We all agree that we must improve the quality of the investigations, and this is largely dependent on the investigative agencies. And then hopefully in the future, we can build a system that really can answer the question, how are we addressing crime that's affecting our communities? But in order to do that, we need the partnership with the communities. We want to work closer. And so this new approach that the NPA is going to follow, and I'm sure the NDPP is going to close upon, is really to forge those relationships that we, particularly with our communities, that we have in place. So NDPP, I'm not sure if there's any other question that I may have missed. But if I did...
Advocate de Kok.
Yes,
I think our issue with Advocate Breitenbach, she will correct me if I'm wrong, it is generally based on the integrated justice system, that you must, at the end of the day, we must have the information from police to prosecution to conviction. That is the essence of the integrated justice system. But we do understand when you say we are not yet there, but we should be building towards going there.
Yes, we wholeheartedly agree, and that also talks to the modernization of the system. And so those building blocks are being put in place, and I think Advocate du Plessis did flag some of that. And we agree wholeheartedly with you on that score, Chairperson and Advocate Breitenbach. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Advocate Kok. Yes, on that, Honourable Chair members, the IJS is really critical. I mean, we cannot overemphasize that. And it is taking a long time, but there is progress, I understand. The Department of Justice hopefully reported on that. But it is, we really need to make sure that you know, progress in that regard is really stepped up considerably. Advocate Rabaji, can you deal with the AFU cases, please? I don't want to keep our colleagues from our members and honourable chair here after dinner time, but succinctly and crisply with the key issues, please, whilst answering the questions as best we can. Thank you. Advocate Rabaji.
Okay, thank you. Yes, thank you very much, NPP, and thank you for those questions from the honourable members. There was a question on slide 8, which is the AFU E&E targets below 75%. Are you saying you've only achieved 25%? The answer is yes. 99% conviction-based recoveries. Also, I think the reading is correct. So let me deal with the first question, and this the NDPP dealt with briefly. So it's specific to preservation of freezing orders in the corruption space. So you would have noticed when I reported on the work we've done on corruption as law enforcement, including ID, the DPCI, AFU, and SCCU, this target has now increased at end of quarter two.
we are above 45% of targets because of those big preservation matters that the IG has done, the 1.4 billion, the 500 million untapped restraint order, the big matter from Free State at end. So this has changed. We are sitting at 45% above target. So at the end of the next financial year, we would have very good news as far as that target is concerned. The second target, yes, it's sitting under ASU, which is where you've got recoveries that were matters where people have already been convicted for corruption matters. Now, equally, this is sitting predominantly in the IT space, state capture. The very matters that is the first target where we've done extremely well in preserving or freezing the assets. The convictions, the cases must be finalized before we can forfeit those assets finally. So it's a lag issue. You need 3, 4, 5 years before you can do you can achieve those convictions. Then just a quick one on who audits CARA is treasury. Where is this reflected? What are the funds for? The funds, it's stated in COCA that the funds must be used to fight crime. So the funds must go back to law enforcement agencies. But NDPP, through you, I would like us to write a report on CARA funding, where it started, because there's AFU that put money on CARA, and they've put so much in CARA since inception. The 6 billion that has gone back to victims, I want us to do a full report on this matter. I think the last question was on what we call recommendation number 8 on FATA findings, where the issue is there hasn't been process from convictions of corruption in state capture matters. And I think it goes back to slide 8 again. There's very good work that's been done here, and I think Honorable Young's confidence in NPA on this one is not misplaced when he says, I can see there are good plans. So this is one of the issues that between AFU and IG, as well as the financial regulators and FIC, we are tackling recommendation number 8 around state capture proceeds and that and money that has left our shores. There's a task team that's been established under Treasury, which is meeting weekly to make sure that they are the plans in place and there's progress. And we are mindful of time because the next phase of assessment is in less than 2 years. So I can leave it and NDPP. Thank you.
Thank you, Advait Rabaji. Before I ask Advait Sonia to deal with the ID issues, Honorable Jela, I think you raised the issue regarding concerns with stability, ID not yet in shape. I just want to say that the 2.5 years have been extremely challenging, and it's actually not unusual when you have to create a new entity to actually, 2.5 years is actually not that long a time. There were various issues that needed to be dealt with, getting the strategy, the structure, looking at, you know, there's so much in terms of resources, and the ID is moving into the building, has moved into the new building. So as Advait Pania said, they are finally have their home. And as she also said, the ID is well positioned to deliver in the next 6 months. So hopefully you will see significant progress in that regard. Hamian, over to you to deal with the questions related to the ID. And Victoria.
Thank you, NDPP. Thank you, honourable members. The first question is, what happened with the Gupta red notices?
I think firstly we have to concede that putting out a statement saying that red notices were issued in relation to all the four members of the Gupta family, in respect of which we applied for red notices, was a mistake. What happened was there were eight accused that were no longer within the borders of the country, in respect of which we requested assistance from Interpol. Interpol responded saying all the four of the eight, they had issued red notices. The other four, they said, were still under consideration by the Commission for the Control of Interpol's Files, the CCF. The CCF is an independent legal body that ensures that all personal data processed through Interpol's channels conforms to the Interpol Constitution, and in particular Article 3, which prohibits any intervention or activities of a political, military, religious, or racial character. What the Interpol system allows for is that an affected party can challenge the issue of a red notice if they believe that the attempt to extradite or return them to the country where we wish to prosecute them is motivated by political, military, religious, and racial concerns. So our red notices are going through a process of review. We've been asked to make submissions. I presume the affected parties have also made submissions, and the outcome is awaited. Unfortunately, our extradition treaty with the UAE came into operation just after we had submitted our request for red notices. We are now obliged to await the outcome of this process before we can proceed directly to request extradition from the UAE in terms of our treaty with the UAE. There are some concerns about whether the Guptas are in fact in the UAE, and it's for that reason that the red notices are essential, because Interpol has about 160 countries that will monitor borders to see they're passing through. So through the red notices, we will be guaranteed identification of where they're located and can direct our extradition request to the correct place. So we follow up weekly, in fact, with Interpol to determine when we'll get a response and when we can proceed with our request for extradition. Our request is ready. Once we get the red notices, it's a question of translating the documents into the country where they are located in terms of that country's requirements. I hope that answers the question about the red notices. The next question I want to address is the questions raised by Advocate Breitenbach. So the question about whether or not the ID has enough money. I think what I've said and what I will continue to maintain is that many of our problems in the prosecution are not strictly issues of budget. And I think Advocate Breitenbach and I are agreed on one thing, that a skilled prosecutor doesn't come into existence overnight, doesn't come into existence from reading books, but comes into existence through exposure to court in and out day after day. And Advocate Breitenbach identified that a number of prosecutors, experienced prosecutors, are leaving the system or retiring. On that front, she said she knew about, she could list seven offhand. Four of them, I've already signed contracts with them to work with the ID on three-year contracts. And so if she sends me the names of the others, we'll certainly look into it. But I think the issue is greater than just budget. It's a pipeline of of growing your skills, of giving people exposure, of training them, and then of keeping up with a rapidly changing world. So Advocate de Kock was saying, you know, we have hundreds of prosecutors in excess of 10 years of experience in the prosecution. The challenge for us in the ID is that many of the skills that we now require and the challenges that we face, very few prosecutors in South Africa have had exposure to. In complex commercial crime cases, I don't know many prosecutors, if you count experience in terms of days in court fighting opposed matters, I don't think we have that kind of experience. And ways in which we can build that kind of experience is our biggest challenge. So that is what I've spent a lot of my time and a lot of energy and effort on. Because when we started, you know, initially there was an idea that we would try and bring people from outside, and we've certainly done that. But let's take the digital forensic skill and capacity that I was asked about. Is the skill and capacity we're getting from the Zondo Commission and contract staff, or are we going to have them around permanently? Initially, they have to be on contract, because those posts don't exist in the prosecution. So we are in a work study process where we have to create posts of digital forensic experts that we can then advertise. We have to benchmark their salaries and get them on board. So that can take anything from a year to, I don't know how many years, to just get to the point where you can now advertise a post of digital forensic specialist with a particular specialization in the new technologies that are being produced on an incredibly dizzyingly rapid pace.
Recording stopped.
I will try to stop as well.
Recording in progress.
Chairperson, so the budget and the strategy that we've asked for, additional budget to help us recruit 20 prosecutors in what we call the enhanced aspirant prosecutor program. And the idea there is to recruit people not straight out of school but university, but 1 or 2 years out. People with specializations in their degrees, in technology, in programming, in those sorts of skills, and then match those people with the senior counsel that we have on board, so that there is a synergy created between what is admittedly very expensive skills out there, which we will also be lambasted for if we rely exclusively on, and growing our own timber.
Recording stopped.
People exposure to these matters and giving them experience, but supporting them.
Recording in progress.
With the retired prosecutors that we've brought on board on contract, with senior counsel externally, and so it's building a whole and creating a whole team of people with expert skills. If you compare what we come up against. You know, in the Nulani case, the case where we got an order against Islandsite Investments, which was owned by the four members of the Gupta family we were just referring to, the litigation that we are experiencing in that matter is enough to keep a serious law firm very busy for a very long time. What we have is one advocate, a state attorney that is carrying a caseload of many other cases. So
recording stopped.
That is not a problem you solve overnight. You have to have various strategies to get yourself equipped while you're fighting battles on a daily basis. So it's true that we've got our new building, and it's been a tremendous impetus to the ID, because, you know, it's been really demoralizing and disheartening for ID staff to work you know, remotely and work in where they do come in crowded facilities. The new building has been literally a new lease on life for us. On the question of non-trial resolution, my colleagues have raised it in their presentations. This is particularly an issue that I feel very strongly about can make a significant difference in South Africa recovering the proceeds of corruption, particularly from corporates. So non-trial resolution is recommended by the OECD Working Group on Bribery as a mechanism that can be used in foreign bribery cases in particular to facilitate global resolutions. And just to give a quick case in point, the ABB resolution that was reached between Eskom and SIU and ABB. ABB paid back $1.5 billion. ABB is a corporate
recording in progress.
So there's the officials who are responsible for the bribery, they fired, and they've assisted us by providing information that will assist us in prosecuting those officials as well as the officials in the state-owned entity responsible. ABB is based in Switzerland and it has offices in New York. So both the Americans and the Swiss and the Germans and ourselves have been involved in multi-jurisdiction investigation to try and complete the prosecution there. Without non-trial resolution, we could not exact a fine in addition to the $1.5 billion restitution claim that ABB made. And so there's two or three other corporates who are in a similar situation. And if, you know, if we had the framework in which to embark on these settlements, I think they are effective mechanisms of bringing much speedier resolution than our courts are currently affording us. So I would certainly encourage that there be more debate and more discussion so that the appropriate policy and legislative provisions can be put in place to support this. I think those are the questions my colleagues answered.
I don't know how much you can say, but the question on SSA, I'm not sure whether you can say anything about that. And I think that was... I'm just looking through my notes quickly, but if you could please be quite brief on it. Thank you.
Members, it is an investigation we authorized about a year ago. And there have been huge challenges in progressing this investigation. Obviously, investigating as a security agency of your own country has several very unique challenges. We, with the appointment of the presidential advisor on SSA, we have been able to resolve some of the challenges we've had in trying to access information, access witnesses, and just generally with cooperation. So I think we are now in a position to make real progress in that investigation. I think that's as much as I can say at this point on the matter.
Thank you. Sure. Thanks, Advocate Premier. Can I ask Advocate Dupont to deal with the matters relating to the HR and other issues, and then the clerk, I'll come back to you. Sorry, Advocate Dupont, and then Advocate Dupont, I'll come back to you.
Thank you, NDPG. Colleagues, I'm very aware that it is now very late. So what I'm going to suggest, Chair allows, is that I deal very briefly with these issues and then provide written comments in detail to them. And the ones that that stand out in terms of the questions that have been asked, the one is on the LP10 that Ms. Breitenbach asked about. And just to make the point there that we are waiting for the judgment. We are engaging with the minister on this issue. At this stage, we didn't want to share too much because we don't know what the judgment's going to be, but we have a number of scenarios in place, and what we will do is provide a written response on this, providing a little bit more information on it. We also were asked about the vacancy rate as opposed to just the numbers. We only gave the rate and not the numbers. The numbers of vacancies are currently sit at 1,527. Of those, about 820 are prosecutor vacancies. But these are not long-standing or old vacancies. They must be new vacancies because of the positions that have been created, particularly in the context of the specialized unit, the SDU, etc. So we're in the process of filling those posts. There was also a question on the fruitless and wasteful expenditure that the chair asked, just to make the point that the amount is extremely low. Doesn't make it not serious. The amount is in total about 5,000 rand, which was in relation to unauthorized use of a vehicle. It's a relatively new case, chair, and the matter is being investigated, and we will report on this later. But as I say, it's only an amount of 5,000 rand, which is relatively low, albeit still very serious. I think many of the other questions have been dealt with by our colleagues, but I think perhaps what I'll do is I'll ask our HR colleagues to give the written responses, Chair, if you agree to in the interest of time, on our skills development strategy, because many of our colleagues have already touched on them in the context of specialized skills and what we do with retired colleagues. Advocate Samir referred to that. But we do have a very comprehensive skills development strategy that has been adopted by our MANCO and our EXCO, and we're currently rolling it out. And what I will do is I'll provide a written response through you, Chair, if you accept that, which provides the detail of that, so we don't go into too much detail on it now, if that's acceptable to you, Chair. And I'll also include the vaccination statistics in that. Chair, is that acceptable?
I think it's fine. I don't see any objection from members.
Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to Advocate Pop. Advocate Pop, we're going to limit your time. You have three issues. You can quickly deal with them very crisply. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. So the first one is the question on the TRC matters. Honourable Member Jele, that on slide 34, we do give an update on TRC. So TRC is receiving urgent priority attention currently at the MPA, and the MPA did, the NDPP did make a recommendation to the minister in relation to the issue of the investigation of all the delays. So I think the minister also indicated that work will receive attention from his office. That's on TRC. On the question on the private prosecutions, Honourable Chair, I think you raised the question. As far as my knowledge is concerned, there's only been one successful private prosecution in South Africa, one. And this was unfortunately a matter in my division in the Western Cape. Some years ago, four years ago, it was a murder case where the prosecution decided not to prosecute. And then that case was prosecuted by way of a private prosecution. Subsequently, we did get involved in that particular matter as far as monitoring the proceedings. There was a conviction, and that matter went on appeal. Unfortunately, I don't know the outcome of that appeal and whether it's been made. I suspect it has not been made because I haven't received the report. But there's only that one that we are aware of. But I will check with all the DPPs just to be absolutely sure that there isn't any other matter that I'm not aware of, Chair. We will be able to come back to you on that. The last one I'd like to deal with is just the fusion centre. So let us say up front that the ACTT and the NDPP and the MPA in particular, we are not really happy with the performance of the fusion centre as a whole. And we think that a lot more can be done to enhance the work. This is part of the work that we're going to do on focusing on corruption and taking those issues that we highlighted in the new priority plan in terms of how we want to approach corruption. But I will give you the most recent stats of the fusion center. So there are, out of the number of incidents registered, there's 233 incidents that have been registered. Of those, 185 are under investigation, and 48 have been closed. So an incident is where there's some indication, either through the media, a whistleblower, that there's wrongdoing. And then that is how it's recorded in the fusion center. A total of 191 cases are registered,
110 of them are under investigation, and 51 have been closed. So an incident becomes a case, and then an investigation, and then 30 cases are currently in court, with 65 accused persons. 16 court cases have been finalized, 15 convictions, and one acquittal. So those are just the general statistics that we have in relation to the Fusion Center. But like I say, and I emphasize, that we also believe that the work of the Fusion Center must be enhanced, and that is something that's being discussed as well at the leadership level in the anti-corruption task team. Thank you very much.
I think there was also one question with regard to numbers. I think it was Honorable Jele that asked it. Sorry, I didn't refer. This is regarding COVID-related corruption. I think in particular, also corruption, SOEs, municipalities, and departmental, and the numbers. So, Chair, if we could also respond in writing to that so that we can give you some of the detail that's requested, that was requested in that regard. Honourable Chair, Honourable colleagues, there are just one or two questions that I will deal with, a couple of questions. The first one by Honourable Janche with regard to my comment that was made at SCOPA. He's absolutely correct. I did make that comment. And the context of it was that the request that came through asked for a lot of detail regarding the investigation of certain cases. And we found it was a bit uncomfortable to give that level of detail. And so that's the reason why I made the comment that the accountability function that Parliament plays, is hugely important. And we take very seriously, but that we need to strike this balance between what we can share in respect of the detail of cases and accountability to Parliament and defining what accountability means, you know, and certainly not micromanaging, but certainly we need to be able to properly report to Parliament without compromising any of the investigations. So that was the context of my comment, and hopefully that adequately addresses your question. With regard to the FATF, I think there was a question about what we are doing to address the, I think it may have been my Honourable Breitenbach, the issues that were raised and the weaknesses in our system. There is a task team and there is an action plan, and we have until I think about a year to really put in place a number of interventions to ensure that we meet the requirements. So there is we are happy to send that report to the chair, and which will clarify exactly what is being put in place to address all the issues that have been raised in the FATF report, which I said is hugely important and reflects very poorly on our country in terms of its international obligations. My colleague has the issue of professional money launderers. I agree this has been a serious gap in prosecutions and hugely important. And you're absolutely right. I think this was Honourable Breitenbach who raised this issue. And this is the issue of the standalone money launderers, where we have a lot of money laundering convictions, but they are predicate offences, almost always linked to predicate offences. And this is something we are focusing on because, you know, the role of banks, insurance agents, even, you know, certain lawyers, insurance companies in corruption and money laundering is hugely important in this process. And my understanding is it's also been dealt with in the context of FATF, but I'm not sure. We will also look into that, but it is something that I have raised in the NPA as an important issue that we need to really look at. But these are very complex investigations. But it's something that certainly needs attention. The issue of building of networks that was also raised, I know that my colleagues in AFU, also in the ID and SECU, have regular engagements with a range of partners in the both locally and internationally. We also have attended UNCAC conferences, and there have been also study tours. So we're certainly building the network internationally in order to ensure that we can collaborate better. Because as we know, you know, the informal networks is what really helps collaboration. Because the formal networks, you know, generally follow that, and it's important that those networks are in place in order to deal effectively with corruption. The issue of, it has been dealt with, the issue of whistleblower protection. I just want to emphasize that there's a lot happening in terms of, as Advocate Dukok explained, you know, what do we put in place to protect whistleblowers? But the reality of the matter is, what do we do now to protect whistleblowers? And that is the challenge that we're facing, because there is no proper framework in place to deal with it. The Witness Protection Act is for witnesses, and that currently the office is located in the NPA. But the Witness Protection Act actually locates that office in the Department of Justice. And the DG has communicated with us, and there will be engagements in terms of where is the proper location for, and I'm hoping I'm not conflating the issues, but dealing with witness protection and not whistleblower protection is the issue of where do we locate witness protection, capacity and capability. Currently in the NPA, but in terms of the Act, needs to be in the Department of Justice. So the DG has asked that we meet in order to decide where is this, should this be properly located. If it's in the NPA, this was an agreement between a previous national director and the DG of Justice or the minister. And so now we are looking into it. And if it's the NPA, then there must be a change in legislation. If it's the Department of Justice, then the Witness Protection Program must move to the Department of Justice. But currently, it's been really well run in the NPA. And as Dukok said, there haven't been any witnesses that have been killed whilst in protection. But that is an important discussion that I think the portfolio committee needs to be aware of. But with regard to whistleblowers, there's a gap. And I know the DG of Justice has called for an urgent meeting in order to deal with colleagues can please mute, yeah. Chair.
Mr. Sambo, can you mute? Can you mute?
Thank you very much.
I will be drunk for the whole 5 days.
No. Masamba? Masamba?
Not sure. Colleagues, you're not muted, so please. I think they're muted. Thank you, Chair. So on this issue, it's a hugely important issue. And there needs to be Zondo, for example, the whistleblowers at the Zondo Commission, that doesn't fall within the mandate of the NPA. But something needs to be done. So the Department of Justice is engaging and recognizes that there needs to be an intermediate intervention that deals with this. It requires many partners in government, but also business and private sector to come together to look at how we can best deal with whistleblower protection now, whilst we look at the legal framework moving forward. Chair, the issue of... I just want to make sure the violence in July, which was raised, as I reported previously, I'm not sure if I did actually, maybe not, but we've been collaborating very closely with the South African Police Service in terms of dealing with bringing to book those most responsible for the violence. The thing is, you know, we got the lower level, we've got the intermediate and the highest level. This was, Chair and Honourable, one of the biggest attacks on our democracy. And if as law enforcement we cannot demonstrate that we cannot hold those most responsible to account, there's no guarantee this will not happen again. So we're working with the DPCI. You know, there are some challenges with regard to capacity and capability, but I know that General Nabiya is trying to really address this, and I think that he might be able to better address this. But as far as the NPA is concerned, we are not investigating it, but we're certainly working with the police. But it requires a lot of very, important skills, and hopefully that's all in place. It should almost be, there should be really, a command center set up to deal with this issue. And hopefully we will be able to hold those most responsible to account. Chair, I think that those are all. I think there was a question about why the regional court, the chair raised, sorry, I've just looked at it now, the performance of the regional court. Chair, if we could also respond in writing, will be appreciated on that one. And finally, Chair, I want to thank the committee for, I don't know if there's any further questions. There was one comment that I want to make quickly before we end. There was a question raised in the earlier session with the Department of Justice regarding the amendments to the SIU Act with regard to asset recovery. I don't have the actual question, but I do want to inform the committee that this is a very, very important issue with regard to the powers of the asset forfeiture unit vis-a-vis the SIU unit. And I think we need to be very careful that we don't, that we are trying to engage with the department. We are aware that there is a draft act, but it's really important that we ensure that there are these processes in terms of consultation happen so that we can do what's best for the country at the end of the day. Chair, I have no further, I think we've answered everything. If there's anything further, we're happy to take them. Thank you, Chair.
Members, have all your questions been answered? I think everybody is happy with the proviso that there are other questions that are going to be responded to in writing. Thank you very much, NTPP, and to the entire team for spending the whole day with us. And you have also proven that self-regulation does help. You have regulated yourself as the NPA, even in terms of time, without any intervention. Successfully. Yes, successfully so. Well, thank you very much. We are here to support the work of the NPA, because people believe that it is only through investment that we will be able to create jobs and build the economy. But it's a combination of many things. The quality of life of our people in general, and that will include safety and security. So I think the view that we should take is that over a long period of time, the criminal justice system has been underfunded. And that is coming back to bite us. And let us not wait until a time where we have a terrorist in our country and to find that our army is not ready, our intelligence is not ready, our prosecution services also is not ready. I think it's important to build capacity now so that when we need it, it will be readily available. Because if we don't do it when we need it, we are going to start building it at that time. So it's important that the NPA intelligence, police, and defense are properly capacitated. And all of them, they are seriously struggling now financially. The debt we owe as Africa is less compared to the money that goes out of Africa illegally. So, and that is partly, that is the criminal of the I think that is part of crime. So one dimension of crime is linked to economic survival of our country and our continent. So it's very important that you are given the resources to ensure that you develop, especially the skills that you are talking about, the commercial prosecutions, dealing with complex commercial crimes. It's very, very important because I think even the Financial Action Task Force one of the things that makes them to be sort of jittery, it's because in their view, there is always a close relationship between money laundering and terrorist financing. So they always view money laundering as a twin sister to terrorism and terrorist financing. So we are going to, I think as a committee, we will continue to raise these issues. And we will continue to back you up to get the necessary resources and to also ensure that the rate at which we are losing experienced prosecutors, we are able to bring some of them back. Because one of the issues that I wanted to raise with you, maybe you can respond in writing, is that during COVID, we were informed that quite a number of advocates in the Cape Bar and the Johannesburg Bar are closing shop because they could not survive. To what an extent has that been a benefit to you? Have any of those people not come or apply to some of your positions to be prosecutors? But those are the things that you can respond in writing. But thank you very much for the fruitful engagement and also the honesty with which you have responded to our questions. We know that legal processes generally don't require just quick fix. You are not running a 100-meter marathon in legal processes. You are running a race. So quick fix solutions are not sustainable in legal processes. So it's important that we must be able to, what we can do today must be done today. That one is very important. Because I think the issue that was raised by Honorable Jelle about the TRC cases, I think our discomfort is based on the fact that each day that passes by, it becomes more and more difficult to prosecute those cases. Because people who committed those crimes are very old now. So each day that goes by, it becomes much, much more complicated. But it's something that we have to work together to ensure that our country becomes a better place to live in. So we will raise this as part of our BRRR report, of much more resources to the NPA and many of our institutions that report to us. Because also we don't want an approach that you have one island of prosperity surrounded by a sea of poverty. NPA would not succeed without the police SAPS being properly funded. So it's important that we have to take a much more of a cluster approach in dealing with those issues. But thank you very much to you for keeping us company for the whole day. And thank you to the members for your diligence. We always go beyond call of duty. Thank you very much. I think it's time for dinner. I think let's declare this meeting to be adjourned.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Members, for your constructive engagement and support. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Guidance. Thank you.
Thank you. So even those who want to drink for the next 5 days, they can do that now. thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. We'll restrict it to the weekend, Chair. Maybe just
recording stopped.
I think we get the recording stopped now, Chair. We have cut lunch.
Thank you. Have a good weekend, Chair. Bye bye. And colleagues, bye. And thank you, colleagues in the NPA.
Bye.